and where we are met with cynicism and doubt and those who tell us that we can't, we will respond with that timeless creed that sums up the spirit of a people. Yes, we can. Yes, 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 it's time. We all come together.
Barack Obama.
Yes, we can.
Barack Obama.
We all can.
Barack Obama.
Greetings, everyone.
And aloha. This has been
Aloha Nui Nui.
Yeah, and if you could pull the whole thing over here closer, honey. Can we move this? All of this is not necessary, right? Oh, dear. I'm sorry. Go ahead, say hello, Rama.
Greetings, everyone. Things are rolling right across this planet at light speed as we are approaching full disclosure first contact. And there are all kinds of stories going on out there from everything. And it is all about the story where, in fact, 33 miners have been rescued today, along with the all 50 states have said, halt the foreclosures.
Well, I don't think they're all rescued. Are they all up?
All 33 miners are up.
Wow.
Yeah. And this says what is going on in Chile as opposed to the situation in the United States concerning the mining conditions. Remember the Massey mine. Mr. Blankenship. And the stories go to the sky.
Okay, but go ahead, Rama. Keep going.
And what I can say is what is happening is that all of the issues happening out there have to do with the party of no that has refused to come back to wholeness, balance, and love. And Mother has said it is over on the train now. And what is occurring is the fact that galactics are showing up anytime, anywhere. All kinds of craft have been seen all over. And I would just say, in terms of stories out there, it has to do with the reality where in which all of, what is happening is the fact that the galactics are here, yet at the same time, until it is over, it is over. And it's not over. A light trim and a home foreclosure? I mean, these are the stories that are going on out there. And,
this is the best news day ever, everyone. And the reason for that is that the people spoke, and it looks kind of strange that the Senate in every state, all 50 state senators, went ahead and agreed to do this moratorium. I'll just say behind the scenes what's going on that note is that these guys are between a very big rock and hard place where they participated and did all this foreclosuring. And now the question of criminality and high treason economically is on their shoulders, so they are going with the people, still attempting to hide, very, very much so, that they're at the source of the problem. And as you know, the party of no in the Senate has not been cooperative, and all of a sudden they have this pretty strong message that we must love them more, and there's more and more decloaking. There's been sightings everywhere.
That Puerto Rico, Seattle. I mean, it is going to the sky, and it is all...
You mean the sky is coming to us?
Yes. It is all about the fact that the party of no has said it is over, and right now they are going all the way on that train to where Mother has said Dracos to stand trial. And first in The Hague, then Saturn, then Dracos. And what we understand is everything is popping up everywhere about the reality where in which all of it has to do with the stories that are, all of it is about the stargates and nothing else. And it is, in the sense that, today Amy talked about the Gitmo Bay situation, how the judges are changing the stories about the detainees and changing the way where in which different folks that are detainees are being reconsidered to never leave these places, and it has to do with the final word, what is happening, which is called full disclosure, first contact, any second. And all of it has to do where at the moment when the time is right, the captain and the admiral will be popping onto the screen with the Syrian commander.
In other words, there's going to be on the media, the Galactics are going to take over the media. Is that what you're saying, Ron?
There are stories about that that go to the sky, just like in 1977. When BBC News was overtaken by the voice of Rilon.
Yes, that was in downtown
London.
Primetime London, yes. And it was for something like 16 minutes. And there was nothing that the studio people could do to stop it. And the message was is that there is no good purpose for use of anything nuclear on Earth, and that it needs to be completely banned from use. And although the ships use nuclear technology in a good way, they will bring it when it's time for us to be galactic in a good way with the starships, etc. At the time, the use has always been for war.
That's right.
There's also a great deal of fear that has been coming through various light teachers. I'm just going to say that there has been some very long events with Ramsa that we heard from our Canadian friends where he's predicting there's nothing we can do and that there's going to be a volcanic eruption and an earthquake in South America and that it's going to cause havoc on the whole planet. And I'll just say right now, it's coming up roses.
That's
this has
right.
been mitigated, and the Galactics are not going to let this thing happen. And this whole story of hunkering down and getting your food—that is—it's a diminishment of who we are. Energy flows where our
attention
goes, as our sister Sharon Reynolds told us over and over again. And we are the co-creators of the new heaven right now and the new earth. And as we believe that someone else can predetermine our fate and that the planet itself can predetermine our fate, what is misunderstood is that at the core of love, which Mother is and Mother Earth is, only that which is for the highest good of all concern can happen here. And so as we put our attention to that truth and remove ourselves from false evidence appearing real and make it so that we co-create again with Mother this new heaven and this new earth right now. And as you can see, Tim Geithner and Bernanke are thinking this is the most horrific idea ever, is to call a moratorium on every mortgage so that the banks are in serious danger of the whole world being in collapse. What we can see is that they are running for their own lives, and they're speaking in behalf of their own skin. And the people are definitely in you might say in power right now.
That's right.
And what we do with this, how we steer it right here, right now, is a critical thing. And do you want to cue up that thing that you got
from Richard?
Yes, from Commander Richard. What are all those blurpy? Oh, okay.
I will just say that it is popping out everywhere concerning the realities where in which foreign donations have been behind all of the stories going on with the issues of this party of no and the teabaggers, and this goes to the highest levels where Tom Hartman talks about that the judiciary branch of this government has been compromised and it's time to send them all to The Hague for war crimes.
Yes, we're really getting in the seat now of the driver's seat. And remember to bring divine mercy and divine compassion with you right now. And remember the movie's coming out, Inside Job, about the financial criminality of our banking system. And it's been controlled through us, the whole world's banking system. And this is just exciting, everyone. It's truly exciting that there's a moratorium across all 50 states for every bank, and that the people are awake enough to realize that they have power and that they can stay in their homes. They can call for an evaluation, and what we understand is there's a full lawsuit from all 50 states against all of the banks.
That's
for the
right.
Fraud of these mortgage foreclosure processes, and that it shouldn't have begun from the very beginning because there was fraud in the contracts themselves. And we are very, 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 very lucky to be witnessing this change. This is and the spiritual energies are guiding this, and awakening to our role as the members of the Order of Melchizedek right now, which is the galactic role of our higher selves coming together, and that all of the children of the rainbow and Sananda Kumara, who says, "I come as a rainbow," and you can look at this in a number of ways. Swami Purna said that there is a rainbow bridge after last year's darshan that we got with Mother in Rama at Swami Purna's feet and pouring the water over his feet and the sacred water and putting the rose petals and the rice. And Swami Purna just grin on his face, and for the first time taking the things that Rama wanted to get blessed and holding them. He's never done this before, and looking at them, and they're the crystals that Rama has been using since 1967 to bring in Mother and to channel Mother and other masters for all these years. And all I can say is that right now, we are in freedom's land, and it's in our hands. And what we do with it is extremely important, and to ground the energies. And Cheryl Croce has done a fabulous work with all the people coming to these calls Sunday night, Monday night, every week, and bringing through those anchor points where the stargates are. And we read that too, in terms of reading about being, members of the Order of Melchizedek. And that, there are 12 major, stargates that have been activated since, harmonic convergence. And right now, being aware of them and using them. And then there's a 13th. And it's Mother Russia Moscow.
That's right.
And outside of that place we call Moscow, in the Ural Mountains, just a little bit to the west, there is the brightest light on Earth emanating from the inner Earth, from the sun, the Terra, in the center of the Earth. And this is, you might say, the heart of Mother Earth as a physical sun, Terra, inside of her being, emanating this light of ascension in Mother Russia. And it's connected with that monoatomic gold coming in from Ursa Major and Ursa Minor. And Ursa Major and Ursa Minor represent the pole, the polar bear energy. You might say bear energy is Mother Russia's energy. And they're talking about bringing in that mono gold that we saw in the film talking about on golden, the golden compass.
Right.
Where in order to save our posterity and our children, we would learn to use our higher gifts now and guide this. And of course, Ananda Kumara as Yeshu, gave many, teachings at that point. And before we go into anything more, I just want to ask people to come and call in. The phone numbers here are 530-413-4511-4515-4520. And just to talk more while people are considering calling in and adding to all of this, I wanted to say that as we headed home on this last 10.5-hour drive, as we left from Cushing, Oklahoma, at our sister and brother's home, Jean and Tom Davenport, and we drove past this place called Oklahoma City, and we were heading home, and there was an earthquake just slightly south of Oklahoma City, and it was the largest one in Oklahoma ever. It was 4.5, and it was felt all the way up into Kansas. And we basically must have been between the fault line and the next spot, because we literally did not feel it as we drove through there and on our way home. And
protected.
And as I understand, I don't believe anyone was hurt.
No.
I believe that it was focused at the university there, just south. I just think it might have, was it the University of Oklahoma? I'm not sure. But, there was some, you know, things like lamps falling down and things falling on a bookshelf. As I understand, no one was really hurt. But that's a very powerful statement that happened here this morning on our way home. And there's been a number of earthquake-like situations. So we're at our Sikh friend's home for the weekend. And it's a very sacred space in Espanola, in the heart of the Sikh community here. And just to remind you, the Sikhs right now have a big job.
That's right. They
always have, because they guard all federal buildings in the entire country. So Guru Meet is the head of the organization that actually has hires the people in the Sikh community to do this work, and it's called
Akal Security Agency.
Yeah, And it's quite interesting that that could be the purpose for us showing up here, is to be where the protection of the guarding of our homeland in terms of the government building, where they are the people's house, all of those government buildings. And I can understand a word. And so, okay, Earl, I see you want to contribute. Thank you, Earl. Hello, Commander on line A1, okay?
Greetings.
Greetings,
Earl.
There are things that, like, happening here in Canada, like there's a whole big shakeup going on, a big lawsuit going on in Canada over our telecommunication company, how they use termination fees for to get more money from the people. Like they'll even charge people for things that they didn't even charge termination fees over, things that people didn't even sign up for. So that's a big thing that's really going on. I think there's a whole big internet shakeup over here in Canada as far as for communications freedom.
Earl, I heard some of it, and Rama, you need to help me if you heard everything. There's a shakeup in the computer
and communicate, like internet commute, like a whole telecom here in Canada, as far as like where they would overcharge people for termination fees, like for their cell phone contracts and for other services that some people didn't even pay have on their contract.
I will say that Canada will follow suit as the United States, as Mr. Harper's going to have to answer for his war crimes in Canada, in the sense where he has not held.
Oh, he did 9/11 with the Bush gang.
That's right.
And so whatever is going on with the communications, I believe that, you know, Harper is in control of those things. So as the shakeup appears to be, what does it look like? What do you mean by a shakeup? What's going on? More specific.
What's going on is they're overcharging people for like termination fees. Like, so if you want to cancel your phone contract, they'll charge you a skyrocket price to terminate your cell phone contract. But they'll also go in, and for some people, they'll add on other charges for other services that people didn't even sign up for.
Well, I think what that's about is that, as you can see, the money that the people are being drained from their own pockets, that the people are saying, we're not going to give you any more money. And so they're attempting to get money in very devious ways, such as what you just described. And they're desperate, and they can't do much without getting more money. And so the people are really speaking loudly by not supporting them in anything that they're attempting to do. So we're going to stay the course, aren't we? And of course, they would try to interrupt them in terms of communications, and they'd figure that people want to stay or go. They're just going to get money out of them, whatever they can, wherever they can. And the people aren't exactly cooperating, are they, Earl?
No, and there's going to be another big shakeup over bandwidth caps here in Canada. Like, and what people don't know is that there's so much bandwidth out there for the internet that there is really no need for capping for people's internet connection.
What about the internet, the people's internet connection?
Well, they cap our internet here in Canada. Like, we have, like, only, like, certain allotments of, like, let's say I'm allowed 100 in, 130 or something like that, gigabytes a month.
Oh.
And,
But
there's more bandwidth out there than what the companies are telling the people. Like, there's this there's so much bandwidth for the internet that there's really no need, and the cost for getting data transmission is low. I mean, you guys in the United States, you can get your bandwidth for $24 a month. We pay like $50, $60, $70 over here.
Good grief. That's true. I understand that because I have lived on and off in Canada, and it was always just exorbitant for things that weren't so expensive down here. And that I didn't have the experience when the Canadian dollar was more valuable than the United States dollar for quite some time. And yet it doesn't seem to make any difference. I know that for sure in terms of your gasoline is just ridiculous.
I can understand, like, if Canada was an island nation, you know, because it costs more to bring stuff to an island, but Canada is a big part of the continent.
Well, you know what? The powers that be are paupers right now, and what they are doing is they're still misusing their power, or the appearance that they're still in power, and they're abusive to the extreme at this point. And also, if you can see that the people, they have organized somehow their energies, and they're using their energies. 40,000 people on Saturday morning in downtown LA and speaking very loudly and clearly that they're not going to pay their mortgages. And then our sister Karen Stewart said there were at least 40,000 people in Atlanta doing the same thing on Saturday. And 10,000 here, 15,000 there, 20,000 there. The activities in other cities were similar. And the people, they realize that the value of their homes is basically cut in half, and they're paying these subprime mortgage loans where there is nothing being paid to the principal, and the value of their homes were that much more than what they're worth now. And they're realizing that the money that they've been giving has been directly to the crook. And then those crooks have been taking and foreclosing on them. And of course, raising their interest rates. I can still remember when in 2005, George Bush raised Markey's interest rate on his credit cards. He had a perfect record for 40 years at the bank with his credit cards and everything he did in banking as a veteran. And so he had no interest at all. And overnight it was 30% on all his cards. And that shot his mortgage payment up 3 times what he was paying overnight. And I mean, lest we understand better the meaning of that, any ordinary person cannot afford that. And so that, you know, these things force people to take out, you know, another mortgage, from the mortgages they had. And to just, and then these things, these were adjustable mortgage rates, which means that they adjusted them all right up. And until the people couldn't do it anymore, and of course they lost their millions and millions of jobs here. And just to help people remember, this was premeditated. It was planned for 100 years from 1891 to 1991, October 1st to October 1st, 100 years to the day. And October 1st of 1991, when that 100th day, 100th year end of every year was done, then what did we get? We got Bill Clinton forming a monarchy with Bush Sr. in the West on that day, on October 1st of 1991, replacing the Bankers Manifesto, which its purpose was to put people out of their homes by now. And I'm just going to say by 1996, they had already put 23,000 American people out of their land and their homes. And the ones that they did that with were huge homesteads that had been, you know, farm homesteads that had been in the people's hands. I'm talking about hundreds of years, 300-400 years in some cases. And I know that at 1996 when they did that foreclosure on 23 million homesteads were foreclosed on by 1996 already, and 20,000 farmer heads of households committed suicide by drinking Roundup so that they could have the insurance on their homesteads for their families in their passing, to live wherever they had to go to live, which is usually in the cities, the big cities. And I mean, this moratorium brings everything they ever did from A to Z to a conclusion now. And it is exciting, and it's also, yes, okay, so now.
Yep, Tara, and also I'm glad to see those miners are being let out of the mine one by one.
Oh, you know what? You bring me back to that. Remember?
Anyway, I'm going to pass the rainbow talking stick, and I'm going to listen.
Okay. Don't go away yet, just Earl. I wanted to go back to that because do you remember when the first 9/11 happened and where? Do you remember?
I was at home. Yeah, I remember when they were like, because I couldn't sleep all that night. So I remember them looking for bodies. They had cadaver dogs and all that. And
okay, now wait a minute, Earl. That was not the first 9/11. I'll bring you back to in South America, in
Salvador Allende.
He was assassinated in Chile on 9/11, 1973. And that was the first 9/11. And why did they do that in Chile? Why did our government do that? And Tony Blair helped. You know, I mean, the government in England helped. Because Chile had a much better democratic way of life and government than the United States had. And they were putting on stage the corruption inside the government of the United States. And so they went ahead and assassinated Salvador Allende, put a dictatorship in there, and then they were murdering people and torturing people, just having a long-term duration of this kind of behavior down there, and they were using that as a way to, you might say, experiment and see how far they could get away with it down there so they could do it up here.
That's right.
That is exactly right. And who was doing this? Henry Kissinger.
Yep.
And he's had extradition on his head ever since. And he has not really been able to travel very freely since then. And as you saw also, they put those kinds of extradition things on our criminals here. I remember that Dick Cheney was trying to get on a plane with a whole bunch of money, and they wouldn't let him on the plane, and they wouldn't let him get out of the country. That was a couple of years ago already.
That's right.
And they've been stuck here, and they've been attempting to maneuver and do things with or without money and pretending all this time. And it's just going to bring everything up now. And I just wanted to say you really hit the nail on the head when you brought me back to them bringing their miners up, because what happened to our miners up here? 29 died in Virginia, right?
Right.
And what did they do? They were just a few weeks after that, another mine shaft was going to explode. And they discovered a rigged problem in both mine shafts. What were they again? The vents. They were reversed so that the vents were supposed to let the gas out so that it wouldn't build up inside the mine shaft. And on purpose, they were reversed so that the explosive, gases were building up inside both mine shafts. And a couple of weeks after this one, the other one was supposed to explode, except good members of our CIA uncovered this premeditated manipulation and corrected it in enough time to prevent a second one. Now, this is really putting the limelight on that was murder, genocide murder, in our country. And of course you've been hearing Barack Obama say, what is going on with our infrastructure just falling apart everywhere and no money being put into putting it together, when China is building monorails to the tune of millions of miles all over their country? And, I mean, these things travel. How fast do they travel? They travel at speeds that are just not even, these rails are, they have anti-gravity technology they're using. Here's,
that's right.
And in the meantime, we have fallen. Yes, we have. This empire has fallen. And yet it is a day to celebrate, because now it's come to the table. And again, the people have filed a lawsuit from all 50 states against the bankers and their controllers, which is the 13 families. And again, praise the work of the King of Swords, Lady Master Nada, and yes, they are the full template of Sananda Kumara and Lady Master Nada return to the planet. and the Office of the Cosmic Christ. They call him Ascended Master Jesus the Christ in the I Am Sanctuary teaching in the Green Book as, you know, the Office of the Christ. Yet at this point, he has risen to the Cosmic Christ seat and shares that seat with the Cosmic Christ, Kalki Maitreya.
Right.
And they're both in physical bodies, and they aren't doing it by themselves. They are leading the way, and they are giving us our power back. And so those of us who are aware and now have the knowledge that we have, not just about the political undercurrent of what has been done in terms of the name of evil, in the name of the Luciferious Rebellious Ones at this time, to take the world economy down. It's in the name of we the people realizing we have power again, and that we're using it now. In a way, we're not by using a killing apparatus, by using our power of our value of money and saying, now I'm going to not do this anymore. I'm not going to feed the beast anymore. And it took a lot of courage over the last 30 years for how many people went ahead. And of course, we know that the Washita people that formed a nation 30 years ago, and 20 years ago, the Grand Goddess, she got a seat at the Hague. Actually, it was in 1993 when it was official, which put the Washita Nation on the map and said that they had a voice in the world court. And then that voice got represented in a bigger way now by Lady Master Nada being a special lawyer. And now she is in charge of our republic. And now, as of June 15th of this year, the Aboriginal Moabite Nation, which in this country represents the original Aboriginal Moabite people of the Washita, and then all other nations of people in terms of their origins, all other, I'm going to say groups of people, meaning children of the rainbow, the galactic children of the sun of every color of the rainbow. Yes, we had seven different colors of the rainbow of people on this planet. And at this point in time, we now have many, 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 many of us that realize what has been done was an ideal situation where we were going to evolve or we weren't. And the best way to proceed would be for us to wake up and to seek the knowledge of the truth. And here we are in our Sikh sister's home where Yogi Bhajan was asked by, he was actually commanded by his teacher to come to the West, not primarily to teach the Sikh energy, to teach Kundalini Yoga. And that's very important. He was sent by his teacher to come here to teach Kundalini Yoga. And as a Sikh, he integrated both teachings and brought them to the West and brought them right here where we are right now to Espanola. And this is the seat of protecting the people's house.
That's right. Yes.
And so the people's house now, to be a Sikh warrior, you might say, you say you will be a warrior for peace, and you will use Excalibur, which is the sword of truth, Archangel Michael's sword of truth, to bring about that peace and cut away all the illusions. And that's exactly what we're doing. Every time we come together, especially on Cheryl's call, that's why Mother said they're the most important, because we're doing something that's called bringing the energy of the highest of all of our energies, which is our monad, our ascended state, and bringing only that divine mercy, divine compassion, and therefore bringing the qualities of the five pillars of the Essene teaching of, you might say, Sananda Kumara in his sixth initiation incarnation on the planet at the time of Yeshu. And now we are the seventh incarnation collectively. That means this time it's not just one being. It's the cosmic Christ energy of all of us doing it together, equal. And Barack Obama did that right away. He signed the executive order to end Guantanamo Bay. And right now, Lady Nestronada, as the head of the Republic, there are energies behind the scenes with the, what's that called? The Center for Constitutional Rights. Michael Ratner and Amy Goodman's brother, his first name, David Goodman.
Yes.
And who's the other one that Tom Hartman always works with?
Ellen Ratner, Michael Ratner's sister, and she has gone to Darfur and Sudan and been on the edge of witnessing the events going on of the spooks that go to the sky, who continue the child soldier games where AK-47s. There was this interesting interview on NPR over the weekend about the creation of the AK-47, and as opposed to the M-16, which is made by Colt 45, the Colt Corporation. And I would just say Mr. Putin is a very enterprising man. He knows his reality in terms of how the game is played. You don't mess with Mr. Putin.
And I'll just say right now, it's even more than that.
Yes.
Moscow is the 13th Stargate fully activated right now. And you might say, in terms of her people, Mother Russia's people, you might say that's Anastasia. And that means Anastasia is connected with the inner earth. Anastasia is that which we talk about as an Agartha being. Agartha is the way they pronounce it in India, A-G-A-R-T-I. And up in the Hindu Kush, those are the higher Aryan galactic people who built the city of light over there, up in the Ural Mountains, up in Tibet, up in northern India, up in Mongolia, up in Russia, where Anastasia lives. And she's what? 8-9 feet tall. She has never worn a stitch of clothes. She's been an immortal. She's been here 450 billion years, exactly like Swami Purna. Okay, thank you, Earl. You brought up so much, and thank you for hanging in there. Do you want to say any more before you pass that talking stick fully, or are you, have you left now? Okay, Earl. I think you're gone. Thank you so much, Earl. Okay, who do we have next?
Chin from Florida is on line B1.
Hello, Chin.
How you guys doing?
All right.
Can you hear me?
Well, we made it.
Well, I just got some good news, and I asked one question. The good news is, at my work, there's customers that come through all the time, and one of them is a manager of a Bank of America. And about a month ago, I hit him up with a question that just threw him back. I said, did you get your new treasury notes in? And he looked at me like in shock. I says, yeah, the ones that are backed by gold. And he looked at me and he goes, yeah, we're going back on the gold standard. And I ordered, but I haven't seen them come in yet. I'll check next time I go on. He's been in several times after that. And today he happens to pop in. And I looked at him and I said, well, did you check? And he goes, yes, I did. And he goes, and you're 100% right. He says, they were treasury notes. So they're in the bank. Just to let everyone know. He's seen them. He verified it.
That is correct.
I think that's pretty good news. I have a question. This is my question. In the past, I asked a question about, will we see these elections happen on November the 2nd? And Mother said no, but not in the sense as we see elections now. What was meant by that statement? I just don't understand that. How are we going to not see it but see it?
Things are transforming faster than we can keep up with what is in 3D, moving to 5D. And as one reality blends with another, what is going on is the party of no wishes to throw this country into a state of chaos and create the atmosphere ripe for the issues that are brought up right now, where Glenn Beck would like to incite riots and violence against the Syrian commander, and that would suspend the elections. Yet also, as our galactic friends are showing up, and all the stories are all over the websites, all over. I mean, it's on Galactic Roundtable. It's on the New York Times. I mean, it's all over. The stories go to the sky about the ships showing up everywhere. And I would also say that as the ships are already here, and it is just another moment before the Syrian commander and the KOS and the rest of the folks step up to the plate, any number of things can happen in unique ways. Where I would just say that it will go to a different way how things are done, as we are brought back to what our founding fathers set up for this nation, where right now campaign finance reform is, I mean, all the stories that are unethical go to the sky. About foreign investors supporting,
especially the lady in Delaware. Every dime of her campaign was foreign money.
Yes.
And this is pretty wild.
Christine O'Donnell, who, doesn't hold any water anywhere other than the fact that maybe Kim Jong-il from North Korea is secretly financing her along with some other folks.
I'll just say that Benjamin Fulford, in the last couple of days, he put out this thing that the 13 families are saying that Barack Obama and his family are not long for this world, meaning he said in plain English they intend to assassinate him right now. And, of course, the Galactics are here for that reason. They will not let this happen, not this.
No.
And again, what a wonderful thing to see someone like Benjamin Fulford as a double agent be able to lead that out right now. And for us to see that it's already too late, that the people already said no more money from our pockets will we tolerate you using against the people. And, I just don't know. It is exciting.
It's exciting and extremely chaotic. And this is why create inner peace wherever you go. That starts with not losing your center no matter what is going on.
Yes. And Chin, do you want to say more? Do you want to contribute anything else? Okay, Chin, it looks like you're complete.
Bill from
Minnesota. All right, Commander Bill. Yes, in Minnesota. Hello, Bill.
Line A1.
Hello, how are you?
Yeah, good.
We're out of breath in a sense. There's so much happening today. How about you, Bill?
Well, I got something that's kind of interesting. My dad recently passed away, and several years ago, probably a good 25, 30 years ago, he took out of his records and gave me the record of my birth. And I was born in 1934, right after our friend Roosevelt got in. And it's a notification of birth registration. It says this is to advise you that there is a preserved in the state of state office of registration of Bismarck, North Dakota, where I was born in Grand Forks County. All right, what's interesting here is it's signed by the doctor, but this doctor was known as special agent for the Bureau of Census. And that's in the right-hand corner of this certificate. And in the left-hand corner, it says Department of Commerce. All right, that's quite interesting. And on the back side, it says the official record of birth, which this is a certified, is very valuable as a proof of age and citizenship. It is necessary to have such proof of in the future life of the child for the purpose of entering or leaving school, obtaining working papers, or marriage license, or inheriting property, or holding public office, or entering civil or military service, and for many other important deals. Now, this was signed by this doctor. And my dad's name, nor my mother's name, is on that. Now, an interesting thing is, in May of 2001, I needed to get a birth certificate certified. So I contacted the Vital Statistics in North Dakota, and I was sent something completely different. And it doesn't have my mother's or my dad's signature on it. And that I was born at Northwood, North Dakota, and the signature down in there is so garbled I can't tell what it is. But stamped on the backside is a seal, a raised seal. It says this is to certify that this is a true and correct reproduction of a record filed, kept, and preserved in the Department of Health in Bismarck, North Dakota. Now, get that, Department of Health. That raised seal says Department of Health, where the original one was Department of Commerce. Now, the big issue right now is what's going on with this U.S. Department of Commerce Rachel and Keith and all the rest have been talking about it these past days. When you received your, I'm sure everybody received the census this year, and on the front of that stamped is Department of Commerce.
I will just tell you, Bill, a lot of the chambers of commerce around this country have been receiving foreign money from outside this country. And it has to do with the 13 families who are, let's say, scared shitless because they know the game is up. Mother is here. She is on that train. They are going with her, and they know They have nowhere else to go, and they are trying to pull off anything they can. You know, the TV show, the event, they want to do something, whether it is Project Bluebeam or a disaster capitalism in the event of foreclosure, fraud, or pulling anything and everything off to declare martial law, suspend elections, anything and everything that has to do with creating the atmosphere of chaos to throw anything off right now and to put you in total fear. And that is the biggest place to not go.
But the interesting thing is that all of our births are signed up under the originally under the Department of Commerce, when now this one is stamped with Department of Health. Now there's a difference, isn't there?
Yes, there is. Remember, commerce is basically, it's run by the Zionists.
Yes.
Who are also equal to and the same as the Nazi people and their consciousness. And they have been, in this moment, severely challenged by the people, because there's just been masses of people that are, you know, over these last years, they have woken up. And they are taking actions that are unprecedented now, where they are not successful in being able to control the people's minds anymore. There's been help. The Galactic have been helping. Remember that, I don't know if you saw the TV version of Steven Spielberg's
Taken.
The movie Taken. At the end of the movie, she's on an Air Force base up in South Dakota, and all these people who had abductions, who had microchips planted into their brains, they all got a message to come and see her. And there was like a sea of people that came to the base. And she came out from the building, she actually helped these people to get all these chips to come right out of their noses. Their noses bled a little bit. They put their hands over there. They cupped their hands, and the chips fell out.
You saw this metal piece fall out of their nose.
This is what's happening right now.
All and our shadows are coming apart.
Our dear brother Mark led the way back here in December. He got his chip out of his brain, and he lived. And that was another very unusual thing, because even in that movie, that was special, because those people would not live ordinarily.
That's right.
Because those chips have been controlled in the dark side, so that they're sentient beings, which means that they would go deeper in the brain as a pursuit to get them out of the brain was made. And they would go where it would cause death if they would go any further into the brain to try to pull it out. And so I'm just saying, right now there's a special dispensation, and people's programs are being lifted. And in the midst of that, as JFK, not JFK, Teddy Roosevelt, Franklin, FDR said, the only thing to fear is fear itself. The people have gotten beyond fear. They've done everything. They've lost their homes. Their children are homeless. There's nothing to be afraid of anymore. And they've turned around, and they've come to a place where they have used their intelligent mind and heart with these new energies coming in. And now the ships are coming for backup. And so in plain English, the health department really isn't much different in one sense, Bill, in that in the higher echelon, remember we said this, that the papacy, that the Vatican has had the highest law of the land on the whole world. And then this registration of the Moabite nation took it higher. And, you know, filing your UCC-1, that's the Department of Commerce that you're freeing yourself up from. And please forgive us. There's a lot of water running and things going on. We have been gifted to be in a place where those things have to go on right now. At least we're here and we're okay. Yet, I just want to make sure you can hear me. What I'm saying is that, the Department of Commerce and the Department of Health, remember what's the higher thing that we learned is that the Vatican, Black Pope, on paper, inside that instrument, which is man-made by the Illuminati family, especially the Rothschild of the West, which is the Kennedy family, and it was cursed by them, called the Club of Rome, and it stated there that the Black Pope owned every square inch of real estate, both on the planet, inside the planet, and in the air, and off the planet. So that, you can see, the Vatican's already fallen in the minds and the hearts of the people with its pedophilia. And they have been funded by the 13 families, in particular, the Rothschild-Kennedy clan. And it's all taken away. How did that happen? When the Aboriginal Moabite nation was supposed to be voted on in The Hague on 9/11, the 13 families blocked it along with their hedge fund managers. And Barack Obama ordered up the hedge fund managers of the 40 original hedge funds, which represented the 40 original notes, promissory notes that Hitler had signed and promised to pay back for the rape, pillage, and plunder of all the natural resources of the Southeast Asian countries, and said, I'll pay you back when I win the war. And the war has been won by the people, and that war never ended until the people said it right now. And the war has been a war in heaven brought to earth amongst our own brothers and sisters. And we said, now we're going to do the right thing. We're going to try our own war criminals. It's never been said before. Why do you think Benjamin Fulford said the first 13 families were planning to make Barack and his family not warm for this world? Because he ordered these 40 heads of these hedge funds arrested. And then at the end of the weekend, he told Hillary that she was speaking racism against the Mexican people. And in terms of this drug war, etc., and he said, you say one more thing that's not true and you're fired. And she hasn't done that. She's done other things. I'm just saying that Barack Obama is being protected by the White Knight. And now the people are protecting him in the sense that they said no more. And they're seeing that the administration of Barack Obama is not Barack Obama at all. It's like day and night. And you can see Geithner and Bernanke are representing that administration, and they're saying we're against all the people of all the 50 states, and we don't think it's a good idea to do a moratorium on the mortgages. Well, it's just not flying anymore. So, you know, the question as to whether the Health Department or the Department of Commerce has a difference. It's only one common denominator, and that is that it's been controlled by the Vatican. And it has the authority vested in the Black Pope to do whatever he wants about any department that we might have in terms of the whole government and every government on earth. And that has been taken away from them by taking the people's support monetarily away from them. I don't know if that answers the question. say some more, Bill, to us. Talk back to us.
The IRS and the Federal Reserve System are not government agencies. That's right, isn't it? They aren't agencies of our government, right?
Well, let's put it this way: they are still owned by the Vatican. Our entire government is owned by the Vatican.
They are private corporations.
That's
what I'm getting at. Now, can we say that both the Department of Commerce and the Department of Health, they are not agencies of our government? Is that right?
Well, they are part of the corporation government.
Yeah.
Which
okay.
is nothing but a fake government. And they are controlled by the Black Pope and the Vatican as well.
And neither is the FDA a part of our government either.
It's a foreign entity owned by a foreign corporation.
The thing is that all corporations are owned by the Vatican and controlled by the Vatican. So even making those differentiations doesn't hold the water in terms of what their horrific way of getting around all of us has been. And I can't emphasize how important it is that the Aboriginal and Mo'abite Nation is on the map right now as a law that is higher than the Vatican. And it represents the people getting free of the laws of commerce, which have never been lawful. Not one second have they been lawful.
Well, the reason I got this birth certificate is because I did in 2000, I filed it with the UCC at that time, see? And I've had that done for those years. Well, that's what I wanted to mention also.
Okay, now did you go ahead once you filed your UCC? Did you go ahead and stop paying taxes and just put them in their place?
Yes.
Good for you, Bill.
And driver's license and marriage license and all that stuff. That was also signed and unsigned, that is, because they were all contracts that most of the contracts we signed to tie us up in their... We've never seen what's in the contract.
So you've rescinded all your contracts.
Right, right.
Very good.
And you did that when?
Well, I began to do it in 84. We perfected it a little bit under common law in early 90s. And we worked it all through common law. And we perfected it later on when I, but at that time I didn't put the UCC one with it. And under the common law in 2000, we finalized it under common law. So we have the strength of the UCC and common law in putting that together. Also, the properties that I had and lost, which are four properties, apartment buildings and so forth, by being a rebel against the system, I lost them all. But before they lost, I put them all under the lodial title and through registration, registered them in the papers, you know, in the legals, in the papers.
Right.
And all of this stuff is filed together in the common law program, see? So it's helped me somewhat, yes. But I'm also in the farm claims, which should wipe out, you know, all the damage they've done to me since the mid-80s, you know.
And I will just say for everyone's information that the black farmers will be receiving all of their funds,
and the farm claims. It's not the black farmers. That was just the name given to go back to Abraham Lincoln when the Emancipation Proclamation did not actualize itself because they didn't get their 40 acres and a mule. That means he coined directly from the treasury, which he went up against the Rothschilds, and that's why his own wife as a Collins, and remember the Collins family is way more powerful than any Rothschild or any Rockefeller or any of these 13 families. Now, they are the ones, and she killed her own husband because of what he did back then, and that's why they want to do this to Barack Obama right now. And because of our White Knight and the Galactic, these guys will be arraigned, finally. And the thing is that back in 1863, the people weren't ready. The people really weren't ready. And they weren't ready to realize that it wasn't just the blacks that were three-fifths of a person. Anybody that was white that didn't have royalty in terms of the wealthy class were equally in trouble. They just made it appear that they could get a job here better or that, but it was completely that the fact is that the people were not ready to really do what you did and started to do in 1984. Even now, you're a rare bird in 1984 doing what you did. Do you know How many people did you notice were doing what you were doing back then, Bill?
We had quite a few people doing it here in Minnesota. In fact, a bunch of us went to that Denver case where the black farmers won the case. I wanted to ask you a question, Tara. You had mentioned that for Denver to go through that case and litigate that in the favor of the black farmers, you had mentioned that the state of Colorado went sovereign?
Yeah.
That is correct. They voted to be sovereign at the legislative state level.
Well, now, do you think they are still sovereign at this point? You think they're acting their work with sovereignty throughout, you know, the rest since then, or was it just for that case?
Well, let's put it this way. It's on the books, and of course, anything that's on the books has to be acted upon by the people. And since the people who are in that state got juggled like crazy, they redid all the districts so that the Republicans would have a complete stranglehold on any Democratic Party, pockets. You know, they just did they rearranged everything so that in spite of that being law, the people were kept from the knowledge of it, and it just, they just used iron fist techniques. I mean, Colorado, for all practical purposes, has always been a police state. The fact that they actually did that, and it's never really been able to be fully embraced is where you're asking me. You know, it's on the book. A sovereign gentleman named Jeffrey Thayer, I don't know if you knew him back then. He was at that event too. He presented back in Santa Fe all the documents and the minutes and everything. I have to go back and find those papers, but as far as I know, it's still on the book.
Hey, I got to mention something. I know we talked about my being in Denver at the time of that case, but we couldn't get in. The court was jammed with people, and we just couldn't get in. So we had little meetings and so forth with other people from around the United States. But the interesting thing is, as we were waiting to try to, you know, outside the courthouse, I can still see attorneys with these carts, you know, these carts that you move groceries with and stuff like that, hauling paperwork into that court. it was just tons and tons of paper that they were hauling into that court. That's the only thing I could add to what really went on inside the courtroom, because we didn't get in. After driving all the way from Minnesota, and we had met people there from Oklahoma that couldn't get in either, see? So I think part of it is, you know, a lot of these courtrooms, they use a room a small room, see, where you can't get supporters into the room. And I think they did that on us, see, you know.
Well, whatever they tried to make difficult, they didn't win that case. They sure didn't.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, that being said, it needs the masses to back it up. And it's taken till now, and the masses are doing something now. Thank God. I am just inside and out. I'm just in awe of it starting to break right now, finally.
Disclosure is moving so fast.
Oh. And thank you, Bill, for your bravery and your courage and your willingness to find out what the truth is and gain enough knowledge to go ahead and do something about it, and to help others and gather with others. And you know, even though that seemed like it was a loss, it was not a loss that you went and witnessed that, so that you could come and talk to us about what you experienced back there and what you did. I mean, every single voice counts. Every single body counts. I mean, what if no one showed up? That would have been a sad day, now, wouldn't it?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so now we've got to guide this. We really have more responsibility than almost anybody else. Those of us who have been studying and becoming wiser by the second and taking the action. You know, faith without good works is nothing. And right now you can see the results of all the good works that anyone has ever done coming together. And we are going home and we're getting free right this moment. And that has to do with us knowing that we are the ones that are co-creating this new dispensation by our very thoughts, words, and deeds aligned with heart, aligned with soul, and aligned with spirit. And we shall not be moved, right? Just like a tree standing in the water, we shall not be moved.
I'll pass the talking stick.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you. Well, I'm just going to pull this up and read it. Because the Bilderberg Group, Benjamin Fulford's been attending those things too. It's a four pager about the true story of the Bilderberg Group, because that's what's busted right now fully. And it has to do with the Rockefeller family. And Tara and Rama, we were talking to a dear sister, Marianne Frazier, here today on the way home. And we were talking about the fact that the Rockefellers have basically owned the oil business in Ohio. Right, Rama?
That's right.
And Marianne, if you're there, you know, come on and help me get this straight. But what I understood in our conversation is that BP took it over.
Big problems,
and the Rockefellers lost their control of the oil business there in Ohio, and they lost it to BP. Yet, let's look at what. Well, did they or didn't they? Remember, we said that everything has been a battle, a war, inside faction one, primarily between the Rockefeller and the Bush. On one side, we would call that group the Rocky and Bushwinkle Show. you understand the pun. And they're the new kids on the block, and who is the others that they're fighting? And it's the Rockefeller, I mean the Rothschild. And that goes back to the Queen of England, or the Red Queen, you might say, presently. And when you go and follow the paper trail of who really owns BP, it's the Queen of England. So this was the Queen of England stealing the oil business of Ohio from the opposition, which would be the Rocky and Bullwinkle show or Bushwinkle show, the Rockefellers. So it doesn't make any difference because that's just their internal war. They want to kill each other and only one is supposed to win. So that being said, let's just read this and put this in our cap right now. And again, I'm going to say the numbers here are 530-413-4511 or 530-413-4515 or 20. And just continue to call in as you have something to share about this energy we're in now. It's just, oh, so grateful. Okay, so here we go. This dates back to November 2nd of 2007, actually. Quote, in 1954, the most powerful men in the world met for the first time under the auspices of the Dutch royal crown and the Rockefeller family at the luxurious Hotel Bilderberg in the small Dutch town of Oosterbeek. For an entire weekend, they debated the future of the world. When it was over, they decided to meet once every year to exchange ideas and analyze international affairs. They named themselves the Bilderberg Group. Since then, they have gathered yearly in a luxurious hotel somewhere in the world to try to decide the future of humanity. Among the select members of this private club, Bill Clinton, Paul Wolfowitz, Henry Kissinger, David Rockefeller, the big news, Brzezinski, Tony Blair, and many other heads of government, businessmen, politicians, bankers, and journalists from all over the world, writes journalist Daniel Estulin in the opening paragraph of the introduction to his must-read book, The True Story of the Bilderberg Group. Nevertheless, in the more than 50 years of their meetings, the press has never been allowed to attend. No statements have ever been released on the attendees' conclusions, nor has any agenda for a Bilderberg meeting been made public, Estulin notes. For some 15 years, Estulin has been a thorn in the side of the Bilderbergers, relentlessly hunting down their secret meeting places, gaining inside sources who divulge what goes on behind those closed doors, even photographing attendees and publicly disclosing it all. Now, he has put it all in a book that every person who values freedom and democracy can read. The Bilderbergers are so secretive, they even try to hide until the last minute the location of their gathering places. Attendance is by invitation only, and as an invitee's name is publicly disclosed beforehand, he or she is disinvited. Perhaps these three quotes will explain what the secrecy is all about. The Times of London in 1977 called the Bilderbergers a clique of the richest economically and politically most powerful and influential men in the Western world, meet secretly to plan events that later appear just to merely happen.
That sounds like the lost symbol.
Happens, eh? Yes, yes. Said Bilderberg Group founder, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, quote, "It is difficult to re-educate people who have been brought up on nationalism to the idea of relinquishing part of their sovereignty to a supranational body." The late prince has been replaced by his daughter, Queen Beatrix, who regularly attends the Bilderberg meeting. Former British Defense Minister Dennis Healey put it this way, quote, "World events do not occur by accident. They are made to happen." And I'm telling you, what Barack Obama did here on 9/11 by arresting those original note holder hedge fund managers, is he busted the power of the Bilderberg Group. He went over their heads. This has never, ever, ever happened. Okay, so what did this Dennis Healey say again? World events do not occur by accident. They are made to happen, whether it is to do with national issues or commerce. And most of them are staged and well managed by those who hold the purse strings. Well, they don't hold them anymore.
No, they don't.
You heard Earl, all the scratching and clawing to get money. Any abusive way they can possibly think up. Every United States president since Eisenhower has either belonged to the Bilderberg Group or its older parallel group, the Council on Foreign Relations. Joe Biden ordered up 9/11 after he was ordered to order it up to tell our CIA George Tenet to do it. And so it goes. The Council on Foreign Relations, or so every U.S. president since Eisenhower has belonged to this Bilderberg Group or its older parallel group, the Council on Foreign Relations, or been approved by them. As Estulin wrote, the race is no contest when you own both horses. That is why no matter which political party is in power, nothing really changes other than the packaging.
And this brings, I don't mean to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
This brings up that thing that we watched with Kathy in Philly, and this guy who he owned the Kentucky Derby. And he went undercover, and I mean, he was the CEO, or still is, and he literally became an employee for the racetrack, and he was shoveling shit, and he was doing the jobs, that the menial tasks, and he never did that before. This guy was the CEO and chief financial officer of the Kentucky Derby, and he spent a month literally just working what it was like to just be like a Walmart employee. After a month, he had a meeting with all of the people in his corporation, and he said, there's going to be some changes. And he turned it around and became a friend to the people.
And he increased their ability to have positions of power. And this has just been going on for the last 30 years in a very exponential rate behind the scenes. And in this country, there have been so many brave young men and women who have found themselves in a position of power to make a difference, and they have put their life on the line.
Yes.
To become whistleblowers, to stop this activity, and that's what we call white knight. And right now, the Spiritual Economics 101 is in place for all of us. And by the way, just I'll continue to read this. I just want to. It just brings up that Rama was able to send from the contributions and the PayPal $444.76, and 7 and 6 is 13, and 3 and 1 is 4, so that's a 4444 numerologically, which is bringing our money where our mouth is to set a spiritual foundation of conscious responsibility or ability to respond to keeping our communication lines paid for so that we can continue to work with this. It's going to change radically right now, everyone. And so this is more important than ever to stay on these calls. And we haven't been able to check because we've been driving today. Our dear sister Penny is sending some money to help. And there are others that are thinking of it. And I just want to thank all the little donations that
people
who have not much money or don't even have that and are doing it anyway, are just scaring it up and making that effort. And we're going to ask you to do it again, so that, you know, starting today, we're building more onto the bill.
Yeah.
Yet, we reduced it by $444.76. from 1500, and our commander, Richard, is sending in the mail. Seth, just keep yours perked. He is sending his $100 that he, on our Saturday call, he said he would match because there are two individuals that sent $100. So in goes that next $100 from Richard. So it'll be coming by the snail mail letter method, yet nonetheless it's coming. Please, let's encourage a few more to put $100 in.
Keep this going.
And I just noticed a very interesting number. Because we did that payment, it's really basically we owe $1,111. Is that interesting? Look at those numbers. 444 brings it to $1,111 we owe. This is, so can 11 people come forward with $100, or can any little group of people just make another contribution? And let's get this taken care of. This is, and we've been given a gift now of seeing that the light is at the end of the tunnel. Where our financial status is going to be upgraded to a very responsible position, and we're going to be given the opportunity now to see what we do with this money that has been passed now. It's being passed right now into our hands, and this could be not a much more. I just want to say one more thing. My sister Shantara called me and Rama and I yesterday, actually the day before. And then, it was only a brief call, and then yesterday we got to talk again, and we were, still at our, Jean and Tom's home, and, I was talking to her about, what the King of Swords had said, that he said by the 15th, which is this Friday, 2 days from now, that it would all break loose in the main media.
And things are already popping with all these ships showing up all over the planet.
Well, on that level, yet we're talking about arrests, and we're talking about on the main media that it would really break on the 15th, and Shantara said, and I haven't been able to talk to Shantara for almost a year, even though it's interesting that Shantara and myself, we met when we were very young, and we were at the Theosophical Society in Chicago, actually in Wheaton, Illinois, and Dora Van Gelder Kunz and Dr. Dolores Krieger, who wrote the book Higher Sense Perception, And the lady that taught that to nurses was that called Healing Touch, Touch for Health.
Mm-hmm.
They were three women, and they were they were having a theosophical convergence of people from all over the world at the Theosophical Society to deal with health. And thank you, Bill, for bringing this up, you know, getting our birth certificate from out of the Department of Commerce into the Department of Health. What an oxymoron. There's been nothing but eugenics programs going out of our Department of Health to make sure that as many people can get sick and die as possible. And so all of these were innovative, you know, and penetrating the FDA with those teachings. So I've known Shantara all these years, and you know, like decades ago, I think she said 30 years ago, Sai Baba told her that on October 15th of 2010, everything would break in terms of the stranglehold that the Illuminati had on the world. And she told me that yesterday when we told her, after not being able to speak to each other for a year, what the King of Swords had told us just a few days before, that it would break on the 15th of October. Folks, this is really happening because the people have woken up and spoken and said, we're finally ready for this responsibility, and we're going to walk this one together now with spiritual economics, where we can turn it around and help each other and pay it forward. Okay, now let's go back to this little Bilderberg story. Just kind of put that in my cap and share it right then and there. So as Estulin wrote, the race is no contest when you own both forces. That is why no matter which political party appears in power, nothing really changes other than the packaging. The puppets who drink at the champagne fountains of the powerful do the bidding of their masters. The people are superfluous to the process. And it is not just in the United States. The Bilderberg Group and its parallel groups, among which are the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, founded by David Rockefeller and Brzezinski, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, based at Chatham House in London, and their interlocking membership are at work throughout the Western world and are endeavoring to get their hooks into the rest. The European Union is their baby. When Bilderberger Margaret Thatcher, the high priestess of privatization, and Rama, you need to set up some music that we need to play a music right pretty soon. Okay. When the Bilderberger Margaret Thatcher, the high priestess of privatization, balked on adopting the euro as the UK currency, the Bilderbergers had her dumped as prime minister and replaced by John Major. Like the Council on Foreign Relations, which in the course of its history has embraced and financed the Bolsheviks, the Communists, the Socialists, the Nazis, and the Fascists, and not the good type of socialists. There's a democratic socialist like Bernie Sanders says, I'm that, and Tom Hartman says that, and numbers of others. The Bilderbergers also play all sides. Thus, in 1980, the Bilderbergers decided Francois Mitterrand, oh yeah, the Wanta Mitterrand Fund, Leo Wanta, Christopher Story, gangland style, assassinated by these folks. Yeah. Because he did more than they wanted him to do. Thus, in 1980, the Bilderbergers decided Francois Mitterrand was to be resurrected and restored to power as France's next president. and that's the International Bank of Settlements is in Paris, France. Yeah. After attending the 1999 Bilderberg meeting, Romano Prodi was sworn in as president of Europe in the fall of that year. When his term ended in 2005, he was elected prime minister of Italy. Estulin makes it clear that these people will use any means, legal or illegal, in pursuit of their goal of total subjugation to their New World Order or One World Company, as they prefer to call it. Wars, coups, assassinations, control of banking, finance, business, the media, education, dumbing down all but an elite needed to run things, and even religion to keep people in check. He notes that David Rockefeller said in his memoir, some even believe we are a part of a secret cabal working against the best interests of the United States, characterizing my family and me as internationalists and of conspiring with others around the world to build a more integrated global political and economic structure, a one world, if you will. As that's the charge, I stand guilty, and I am proud of it, unquote. Incorporated in this group are the neoconservatives, quote, those who have determined that Israel's security should come at the expense of the safety to the United States and be central to all United States foreign policy decisions, unquote. Richard Perle, Project for a New American Century, everybody, is also a regular attendee at the Bilderberg meeting. Michael Ledeen, Lyndon LaRouche talks about him all the time. Nazi Mussolini guy, attended the 2005 meeting. Media mogul, Rupert Murdoch. Rama, can you pull that one up? Can you go to the Huffington Post? Let's play that. John Stewart discussion interview with Terry, what's her name?
Terry Gross.
That we got a
fresh air.
Because that broke up the APAC right in the bud. I mean, you know that John Stewart is Jewish from the tip of his nose to the tip of his toes. And he went after them for the jugular in this little interview with Terry Gross on Fresh Air, NPR. And we'll play that next after a little music break. It's music to our ears. Oh, by the way, tonight, John Stewart is interviewing Condoleezza Rice tonight.
Oh, my God.
Tornado. And, you know, that's Project for a New American Century, too. And we must love them more. They are all guilty of economic high treason and genocide and war crimes. Oh, God bless the one that the American people have voted as the best place to get the true news, John Stewart. And remember, he's going to have a march in Washington for sanity at the end of this month on the 30th of October, which is our sister Karen Stewart's birthday. And what she wants to do for her birthday present is to go there and be at that event. And wouldn't that be neat, as many of us who could show up for that. And then, of course, Steve Cooper, who's doing a very helpful thing. He's having a march on the same day to bring more fear, just to exacerbate exactly what the story is about. Let's just give it a couple more weeks and see the power of the people and their voice when this happens down there in October, the day before the finished Baal again, called All Hallowed Eve the very next night.
Samhain.
Remember, 10,000 Wall Street banksters were arrested in a military base outside of Asheville. It was on Channel 13, and Carolyn Jones got a call from her friend in Asheville at midnight that it was on there on the news, which means that was the very beginning of Halloween, and these 10,000 banksters were being boarded on C-5A Military International 500 at a crack black transport jet, and they were taken to The Hague to solitary confinement. And on the 4th of November 2008, Barack Obama, as his first president-elect order after 6 hours of being debriefed by the CIA, ordered those 10,000 bankers' execution, and along with Hillary Clinton, who had been sitting in solitary confinement since June of 2007, as reported by Christopher Story.
Mm-hmm.
Are we seeing, we are going to see so much now about what Barack Obama really has been doing, and that his administration does not represent him, and he does represent the people, not only here of the United States, of the world, the Aboriginal Moabite people of Earth is who he represents. And this is happening. Okay, you got to go turn off the tea.
Mm-hmm.
It's done, so we can fill up our cup. All right. Okay, look. So let's see what's back here. Okay, so. All right. So Richard Pearl is a regular attendee at Bilderberg meetings. Michael Levine. Media moguls as Rupert Murdoch, the now disgraced Conrad Black, Viacom, parent company of CBS, CEO Sumner Redstone, The Washington Post, Catherine Graham, now deceased, Washington Post columnist Jim Hoagland, and Charles Krautzimer, New York Times editor Arthur Salzberger, and columnist Thomas Friedman, oh, another not nice guy, another Mussolini guy. William Buckley Jr., yabba dabba doo, Bilderberger, and he participated in the assassination of JFK. Yes, indeed. And Bill Moyers, Council on Foreign Relations, and Bilderberg, representative. Now, he's a good guy. He's a double agent good guy. Yet, true enough, both and. Quote, and he resigned, you know, he retired. What was that, back in April or May or something? From NPR. quote, the ideas and policies that come out of the Bilderberg annual meeting are used to generate the news in the leading periodicals and news groups of the world. The point is to make the prevalent opinions of the Bilderbergers so appealing that they become public policy, and to pressure world leaders into submitting to the needs of the masters of the universe. Did you find it? Okay, good. And now go pick a song so we can play that in between. A really good song.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what. Democracy Coming to the USA or Rulers of the World with a song that maybe something good. you pick the one that you want. Okay, the free world press is completely at the mercy of the Bilderbergers, disseminating the agreed upon propaganda, Esplin points out. This is just a smattering of the information Esplin has managed to pack into his well-written 340-page book, complete with photographs, documents, and an index. Okay, before I go on, I forgot to mention, I got to mention it now. In order to help pay for the for our BBS radio, you must go directly to BBS radio on tonight's call or Thursday or Friday or Saturday. And the way you find how to find the PayPal button, you click when you get to bbsradio.com, then the home page at the top in the middle, there's a button that says Station 2. You click on that, and it'll take you to where you scroll down until you look at the schedule. And there you'll find the Galactic Healing Call for Wednesday. And you click on that, and then you scroll down again, and you'll see the button where you can push and make a PayPal donation. Now, that being said, we also said that you can also pay by snail mail, as you do not have a computer. I'm going to see if I got that address written down here. Right. And if I don't, just request again. I don't right now. So, yes, Commander, there at the station, Seth, if you'll put it up there on the board again, we'll read it for people so that people who do not have a computer can send it directly to you in the mail. And thank you, everybody, at the time when things are thin like this, that you can take what you have to tide us over. Things wane in terms of money, time, love, energy, and air to breathe at the darkest hour before the dawn. And that's where we've been right now, and now we've got a breakthrough. And so, that sounds good. Is that going to be a full play?
Mm-hmm.
All right. All I want to say is let's give ourselves to love now. As the King was saying, as we're doing our Mighty I Am activity too, what's really happened there is things have reversed. And we have been given the role of pay it forward in the sense that we have been grandfathered in at the highest level so that now as this breaks through and the arrests are made, we're going to see the Nasara announcement and we're going to see our blessings come into our community. And we are going to be able to bless people into the activity so that they can start to bring their neighbors and friends with money into the activity. And it happens very quickly once we can help this happen at the beginning with our blessings. Right now, it's still a very skinny, narrow financial window.
A keyhole.
Let's just keep our ability to stay on BBS radio alive. Thank you. All right, so this is just a smattering of the information Estulin has managed to pack into his well-written 340-page book, complete with photographs, documents, and an index. As all this seems far-fetched, look around, and America has been stripped of its industrial base. The good jobs have been or are being offshore, while Americans are working harder and longer at service sector jobs for less pay and fewer to no benefits. Americans have been dumbed down in public and private schools, universities, and colleges. Their only worth now is as consumers of mainly foreign-made goods. They are kept in check by religion, sports, idiotic reality TV, video games, and anything else that turns off thinking, democracy, freedom, national sovereignty are anathema to the wannabe masters of the universe. Yet the Bilderbergers and their parallel group and allies think tank have been working to do away with all three. Elections have been rigged. The U.S., Canada, and Great Britain are on the verge of police state mentalities across the board. Well, that's already gone over the edge. The U.S., Canada, and Great Britain are on the verge of becoming police states thanks to the bogus war on terror used to pump up people's fear. And the people said, no, we're not afraid anymore. Right here, right now. All that remains in their grand plan is to replace the last vestiges of sovereign nations with a series of regional unions that they will control via the United Nations, outlawing all nationalism. Yet they have overplayed their hand as the grand scheme is fraying around the edges. Not all Europeans are ready to surrender their country's sovereignty to the EU. Canadians who know more about the plan for a North American Union than Americans are diametrically opposed to it. A revitalized Russia, which has a historical war wariness of outsiders, has its own ideas. And despite all the Western investment in China, Beijing is proving to be a problem in its refusal to float the yen, to bail out the financial mess the greedy Bilderberger bankers and financiers have made. Remember, this was November 2nd, 2007. Look how far we've come. Which may explain the Carlyle Group's sale of 9.9% of itself to the Chinese as a hoped-for hook to bring China to their table. Unsuccessfully, you see. As the old adage says, knowledge is power, and Daniel Estulin is providing every reader of the true story of the Bilderberg Group with the knowledge they need to aid in destroying the Bilderbergers' grand plan by bringing it in to the attention of family, friends, and colleagues. It is up to us to get this book into as many hands as possible, because Estulin will get no help promoting it from the corporate media. Collectively, the people hold the power to save themselves, and that frightens the Bilderbergers to no end, as well as it frightens their cohort immensely and the most. Yet that power is useless as the people refuse to exercise it or surrender it to those who would enslave them. So I just thought I'd go over this because we've done it. We've got our power back now, everyone. So Rama wants to play a song and then we'll be back. So this is called Equal Rights, correct?
Correct.
All right. Is that by Playing for Change?
Yeah. Murmansk, Kerlonski, Jason Tomba, and the rest of Afro Fiesta performed this classic Peter Tosh song from a park in Cape Town, South Africa.
Everyone is crying out for peace.
Equal right for justice. Everybody's calling out for peace. Thank you everyone for listening. And we're going to play an interview now between Terry Gross and John Stewart, the most trusted name in fake news. John Stewart. And this occurred on September 27th, right?
No, October 4th.
Oh, October 4th. I'm sorry.
But the interview happened in September.
September 27th, yeah. Okay, so let's just start.
Okay.
This is really good stuff.
Support for NPR comes from Progressive Insurance, sponsor of the Progressive
Automotive. Sorry, we just got to get through the commercial.
Cars that exceed 100 miles per gallon. That's progressive.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We've got a special show for you today, an interview with John Stewart that I recorded last Wednesday night on stage at the 92nd Street Y in Manhattan before an audience of about 1,000 people. The occasion for the interview was the publication of the new book by John Stewart and the writers of The Daily Show called Earth, A Visitor's Guide to the Human Race. Mm-hmm. It's a collection of satirical descriptions of human history, including evolution, religion, democracy, fascism, music, and TV. Stewart has been hosting The Daily Show on Comedy Central since 1999. The show's two Peabodys and 11 Emmys are examples of the widely held opinion, which I share, that Stewart is a brilliant satirist of politics and the media. He's been in the news lately because of the Rick Sanchez story, which happened after our interview, and because he's organized a rally on the National Mall for October 30th that he's calling the Rally to Restore Sanity. And Stephen Colbert, whose show The Colbert Report was co-created by Stewart, is organizing a counter-rally whose theme is Keep Fear Alive. The 92nd Street Y, where I recorded the interview with Jon Stewart, is famous for its lecture series, its lyrics and lyricist series, as well as its programs about Jewish life. I just want to say, thank you, before I ask you the first question.
You're welcome.
Thank you for
The last thing I see every night, in addition to my husband and my cat, is your show. And I'm able to go to bed with a sense that there is sanity someplace in the world.
Oh, that's very kind.
And...
Now, this is going to sound weird to me. The last thing that I see before I go to bed is you, your husband, and your kid. For some reason, on my monitor, in the studio, it shows up. It's very surprising.
Sanity with punchlines.
Sanity with punchlines.
It's great. So let's start with your rally to restore sanity. So it's the Million Moderate March to take it down a notch for America. And everyone is trying to figure out, is this a new breed of comedy festival, or is this like a political march to bring out the vote, particularly like the younger voters? Like,
right.
Tell us what it really is.
When we figure out what it is, Terry,
you can call me.
We're going to be delighted. First of all, I want to thank everybody for coming out. It's an honor to be at the 92nd Street White, which, I don't know if you know this, the third holiest site in the Jewish religion. It's very exciting for me. We'll get here. There's the Wailing Wall, Say Bars. So, obviously, for me, this is an honor. And it's a real treat, and to see such a big turnout this close to the end of Sukkot is really. I know how tired everybody is from the hammering and the hoorah and shaking of the lemon. I gotta get these actors, honestly, it's the only place in the world this stuff works. There's nowhere else I can work with it.
But what is the march?
The Lulav, but the march. The march is, like everything that we do, the march is merely a construct. It's just a format. In the same way that the book is a format, you know, a show is a format, the book is a format, to translate the type of expression that we do, whether it be a satire on the political events. It's a format to be filled with the type of material that Stephen and I do and the point of view. So it's not, you know, people have said it's a rally to counter Glenn Beck. It's not. It's what it is we saw that and thought, what a beautiful outline, what a beautiful structure to fill with what we want to express in live form, festival form.
How did you cook it up?
Insomnia. When I had heard about it and what was happening Glenn was going to do the rally to restore honor, and I thought, man, that's a great idea. And I thought, it's a perfect, he's a reaction to what he feels like is the news. And so are we. We actually share, I think, quite a bit in common in terms of not point of view necessarily, but reason for being. We're both, in some ways, an op-ed. We consider ourselves sort of editorial cartoonists in some respect. Not him, but as a chef. Op-ed cartoonist or the Messiah. Yeah, we're both different. But I very much wanted to avoid the idea that it would be a reaction to him. And because I don't think that'd be fair to him, and I don't think it's not meant to ridicule activism or the Tea Party movement or religious people. It's meant as, again, a great construct to express kind of the dynamic that we like to express on the show. So he was outraged, and he was going to do a counter rally. So I thought, what a great way to remove it from the premise of a reaction to what they were doing, and let Stephen and I embody the two things and fight, you know, Harry Potter, Voldemort style, you know, together. You know, so much of what The Daily Show is just a deconstruction of the way that news or the way that a political campaign is put together. And so much what Stephen does is a deconstruction and then a reconstruction through his character's prism.
Now, some people are worried. There's a big AFL-CIO, liberal marches, the AFL, the NAACP, a whole bunch of groups. Some people are worried that your march is going to take away from their, like, serious political march.
Right. Yeah.
Why do you say that?
I have a job. I don't have to do yours. I don't have to do their job. Let them do their job. If their job is to motivate voters and to rally people to their cause, God bless. Do whatever you got to do, but that's not my job. My job is to, again, express our point of view comedically about what we view as the political process. You know, I have no obligation to the Democrats or progressives or liberals or unions. Our feeling is corruption is corruption. If a union is corrupt, you can't leave it alone because it's a union. And they help so that 8-year-olds don't work in factories anymore, you know. You have to go where you feel like the absurdity is. So we're not anybody's, we're not warriors in their cause. And if they're upset, they should have thought of that, you know, the past couple of years before they lost, you know, the momentum that they had gained in 2008.
Now, are you nervous at all that tens of thousands of people are going to leave their homes and travel long distance because you asked them to?
Yeah.
And anytime there's this like huge rally right. in the National
You're
Mall.
You're shaking my head too.
Exactly. No,
I mean,
it's like worse than throwing a wedding or something. I mean,
no, I'm nervous about traffic.
Yeah. No, I know, but it's like,
I'm nervous. I would like to see a bus that's just filled with Purell go down there. I don't, you know, I'm nervous for everybody. I don't want people to get sick. I don't want them. We're at the rally. We're going to be, we're going to have, you know how rallies usually have like things you can buy. We're going to sell scarves. I mean, it's the end of October. It could get chilly. You know, you don't want people to go home and go, we went to this rally. We had a great time. Really fun. I mean, it is, everything is being done with that idea of peace in mind. The charity that we're donating to is to restore the National Mall. We feel like, you know, there are many very worthy charities, but we feel like we're going to be using that space. We should, in some ways, the reasonable thing to do would be help restore it after we leave.
Now, my impression is
yeah.
that if you weren't throwing the march, so to speak, if it wasn't your party rally, whatever,
yes.
that you'd never go. You strike me as the kind of person.
I think that's an excellent point.
Yeah. You strike me as the kind of person who'd never be at a demonstration. Yeah.
No, it's a rally. It's one day where non-joiners unite.
Yes, okay.
You know,
very good.
It's that type of the dichotomy. Yeah, there's a tremendous amount of contradictions in terms of what we normally do. But we think we won't be contradicting ourselves content-wise. And for us, that's always been the main thing, is to keep things consistent in the reason of it.
Now, we brought a couple of clips.
From the Daily Show?
It's not from your movie.
Are we going to watch the Daily Show, the event?
So,
I've heard very good.
Although the rally isn't directly inspired by Glenn Beck, I think
right.
there is a bit of an echo here. So, I know, we play yes. the Glenn Beck clip first, because you are so funny. You recently devoted a show, been part of a show, to your impression of Glenn Beck.
Yes.
And it was so funny and so good and so right on the money. So I want to play a clip. I don't know if you saw it. I don't know if you saw it or not when it was on, but you'll get to see it now. And this clip actually starts with Glenn Beck himself, a clip from his show that you will then comment on. Here we go.
You just blew my mind.
Progressives think they know better than you do. They want to control every aspect of your life.
I didn't know that that's what I wanted, but I guess I want to control every aspect of your life. As progressive, I might say, oh, I think it's a good idea for an agency to monitor pollution. But I guess what I really mean is, it's in the state's interest that we'd be allowed to put a chip in your head that tells you when you can masturbate. Total control. And in my America, nobody tells people when they can masturbate. That is a decision. That is a decision that should only be made between myself, my doctor, and that new Calvin Klein billboard outside my window that's lit 24 hours a day. No, not that one. The new one. The new one. Ew. No, the new one that's got the... Yeah.
So I'd love it if you could kind of take us behind the scenes a little bit and tell us, like, what goes on? Like, how did you try to deconstruct Glenn Beck and figure out what is his logic that you're going to apply in your version?
The beautiful thing about what he does is it's very difficult to argue with his facts. It's the conclusions. You know, you can string together all type of facts. It's sort of like, the old thing where, like, you know, he's got a thing about progressives that if you somehow believe that the country should have some type of social safety net for, you know, our least fortunate people, then you believe that the government should control the banks and also all of our institutions. And you're, you know, it's that slippery slope, and he'll come up with, you know, these little arguments that go along, and but the conclusions he draws. So what you do is you just grab together facts, and then you take them and you put them together and do a grab bag of conclusions. You know, it's everything is discovered as evidence of secret plots, you know, secret things that could be occurring. You know, you take the word, conservative or libertarian, you know, you break it apart, you know, libertarian, for L-I, lie. Why would the word lie be in there? And then Bert. Bert was the gay communist half of Ernie and Bert. Why would that be in there? And if you, Aryan, do you see? Aryan is the last, they are Nazis. You know, and you blow it all out as though it's a conspiracy, and it's easy to perform because it's comedy. So when I watch it, it's fun for me because as a comedian myself, it's easy to do. You know, you do the whole. You know, I didn't want to be the one to have to do this. But the country is dying. You know, and it's just like, you just make it all seem like it's just popping in your head right there, and you're just a concerned citizen reading a teleprompter.
So when you did that bit, and it ended with, there'll be a government chip in your head telling you when you can masturbate, little did you know then that masturbation would become an issue in the campaign. Poor Christine O'Donnell.
Poor Christine O'Donnell, which said something on MTV 20 years ago. I'm the last person to judge someone who said weird things on MTV 20 years ago. I feel like, again, this woman, Christine O'Donnell, she may be qualified, she may not. I'm not that all that impressed with what's in the Senate right now. But the last thing that I would suggest is that her witchcraft or masturbation stance is what we should be even thinking about or focusing on. And I think that's an enormous mistake that the Democrats will make. Because we like to sit around the office and try and think, we have a little game called How Will Democrats Blow It? And that's the way they'll do it, is they'll think somehow that will resonate with voters. That 20 years ago, Christine O'Donnell on MTV said masturbation, you know, is a sin. And, you know, they'll play it and they'll ridicule it, and the voters will be like, yeah, I don't have a job. That's how they'll blow it.
But this stuff is a payday for comics, which leads me to something very funny that you did on Carl Paladino's win in the Republican gubernatorial primary in New York. So I brought a clip of that. So let's watch that. And this was right after he won the Republican gubernatorial primary.
So who were our winners last night? Well, meet new Republican nominee for governor of New York, Carl Paladino. He's a Syracuse Law graduate with Barry Goldwater's fiscal credentials and Abe Pagoda's bedroom eyes. Oh, and there's also this.
Paladino's emails to friends and business associates. They contain racist jokes, porn, and bestiality.
Racist jokes, porn, and bestiality. I was told this was going to be a tea party. Ooh, I didn't know they horses a tea party.
But Paladino had a good explanation for the raunchy emails.
I forwarded emails. I'm in the construction industry, okay? I get a lot of this junk sent to me.
And a lot of that junk just happens to be videos of broad banging horses. So what am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to not forward it out? I mean, come on. What part of I'm in the construction industry don't you understand?
Okay, when the real world is as funny as that was, what happens at the morning meeting on The Daily Show to figure out what to do with it?
Honestly, you know, for the most part, it's the type of candy that we have to avoid. It's like when we come in the morning and there's donuts and you're like, I should probably have, I should have some granola first or something. So we try to limit our intake of sugar, but it is, you're right. It's like crack cocaine for a comedian. And you try to, because if the whole show is that, then it really does begin to spiral out of control into what appears to be a litany of masturbation and bestiality jokes.
Tell us a little bit about what the morning meeting is like.
The morning meeting is, as we call it, our morning cup of sadness. We get in you'd be incredibly surprised at how regimented our day is and just how the infrastructure of the show is very much mechanized. It you know, we come in and it's not, people always think, the Daily Show, you guys probably just sit around and make jokes. And we've instituted, to be able to sort of wean through all this material and synthesize and try and come up with things to do, we have a very kind of strict day that we have to adhere to. And by doing that, that allows us to process everything and gives us the freedom to sort of improvise. I'm a real believer in that creativity comes from limits, not freedom. Freedom, I think, you don't know what to do with yourself, but when you have structure, then you can improvise off it and feel confident enough to kind of come back to that. So the morning meeting is at 9 o'clock, and what we've done is we have, I guess you call them mole people that live in a little subterranean area of our building, and they are charged with watching all of these shows. And they are just tragic, tragic individuals. They are, they live lives of true, sadness. They're the mole people. They are, someday they will be free. And we will all celebrate their freedom. George Bush will come in and free them. So the morning meeting is, it's typically what are the top stories and how have they been covered? We have a 9 o'clock meeting and a 3 o'clock meeting. The 9 o'clock is to kind of rehash the sort of analysis that we were going over the night before to see if the premises and hypotheses that we had come up with the night before have come to pass. And what's the video evidence? And then we take that and we sort of, then we begin to knit it together for, writing assignments. And then those writing assignments are usually coming back in at 11:30, at which point we begin to read them. There's really, the day is very interesting. Then we read them, and go over the notes of how we want to attack it. We don't have enough there. We'll push it back out to the writers. They'll come back at 12:30. And the day basically goes as sort of a little dance of collaboration between writing and rewriting and including all the other elements of graphics, all those kinds of things to put together.
Now, one of the things that The Daily Show is incredible for is what I've come to think of is the hypocrisy videos. Most recently, like the Boehner versus Boehner one, where you had John Boehner presenting the new ideas of the Republican Party. And you juxtaposed him saying exactly the same thing, and I think it was 1993.
Right.
So what he'd said just a few days ago.
That's right.
And you did that, like, with Glenn Beck, for example. You had him saying, you know, the government should never tell us what to do, and then you had videos of Glenn Beck telling us what to do. And you do that all the time with politicians.
Right.
And the videos go back a long way. How do the people on your staff find those old videos?
Well, you can search on NexusLexis if you have an idea of what you want.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, if the idea is when you see the pledge, so your obvious first thought is, okay, the pledge is the same as the Contract for America. So let's go back and look at the Contract for America. It's all about just making connections and then looking into it using search words. It's
journalism. It's called journalism.
I don't think so. I think it's called Googling.
Yeah, but
I think we Google. We tend to Google.
I often feel like, how come I had to find out about this on your show, on a comedy show?
That's funny because we often do. But it's not, the reason why I don't think it's journalism, the reason why I think it's analysis is we don't do anything but make the connections. We're just going off our own instinct of what are the connections to this that might make sense. And this really is true. We don't fact check and we don't look at context because of any journalistic criterion that we feel has to be met. We do that because jokes don't work when they're lies.
Mm-hmm.
So we fact check so that when we tell a joke, it hits you at sort of a guttural level as opposed to not, it's not because we have a journalistic integrity. Hopefully we have a comedic integrity that we don't want to violate.
One of the amazing things you did on your show, after South Park did its Prophet Muhammad sequence over the summer,
mm-hmm.
and the whole idea was that, you know, the Prophet Muhammad was like hiding in a truck, I think, like under a shroud or something.
Bear suit.
And in a bear suit, right. And you're not supposed to depict the Prophet Muhammad visually.
Especially in a bear suit.
But it turned out it was really Santa Claus. It wasn't the Prophet Muhammad. But.
And then at the end, you were like, why was Santa really hiding? It didn't really make a lot of sense.
But still, a lot of people, I think a lot of Muslims were very angry at even.
I don't think even a lot were.
It,
I think there were certain.
Some
extremist groups that.
Yes, right.
Expressed their.
And there were death threats, I think, against.
I believe that's correct.
Yes, the creators of South Park. And you did an incredible thing afterwards. You devoted a segment to it, and then you said, I say to anyone who's threatening death in the name of religion or politics, and then a gospel group came out, and then, you want to say what you did?
I believe the phrase was, go
yourself. Yes.
And then we dance and sang. Can I tell you the most difficult thing about that? Finding a gospel group that'll sing the so. I tell you, they're not easy to find. We call a lot of churches and we're like, do you have a gospel group? Yes, we do. Would they possibly come on and sing go f*** yourself? And they're like, yeah, we can do Amazing Grace. Can you do, you know, so the negotiations to get them up there were difficult. But, I think the lesson that I sort of took from all that is, again, there's a difference between disagreeing with people, like newscasters on Fox News, that I think are incorrect in their analysis of the day's events, and people that threaten to kill you for putting a cartoon image of Muhammad in a bear suit. And that's a line that we too often forget. And it's very easy to dehumanize, and I will say in this room, I would imagine, you know, Beck and Palin are easier punching bags, and you can think of it as, oh my God, I'm so scared if they take over. And you know what? We'll be fine. You know, we had a civil war. Just, we're not that fragile. And I think we always have to remember that people can be opponents, but not enemies. And there are enemies in the world. We just need the news media to help us delineate. And I think that's where the failing is, that the culture of corruption that exists in the media doesn't allow us to delineate between enemies and opponents. And that's where we sort of fall into trouble.
Now, in terms of consequences.
We are the world. Yeah. Love on the rocks. Ain't no surprise. Something.
That's good. That's good. Okay.
Maybe we were born to run.
So it strikes me that your interviews have gotten more serious over the years. Not all of them, but some of them. Most famous, Jim Cramer. One of the most famous, Jim Cramer, which basically held him and CNBC responsible for the financial meltdown because they weren't really reporting it. And what I mean by that is you accused him of being able to see this coming, of knowing mm-hmm. the things happening behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. So what were the repercussions of it? Because he certainly...
He was sad.
He was sad. Yeah. I think he expected something more humorous. And you
probably.
But anyways, I guess what I'm really wondering is how it left you feeling about doing really serious interviews with someone.
Well, I don't care for it. I'm not, you know, I think I've done, you know, three like that in 12 years. The intention is never to go out there and be humorless and sanctimonious. Not that I can't do that, you know, and have shown that in the past. But some of it is the alchemy of the person's reaction to how it's being presented to them, their reaction. If there are moments in a conversation where you become infuriated, it's never the goal. And the entire sort of ideology of how it all happened is silly. We were basically making a case. The Jim Cramer Bear Stearns stuff that we ran, and I don't know if anybody's familiar with it, but it was, you know, right before Bear Stearns went from, you know, $60 to 6 cents, you know, like that week, he was like, Bear Stearns, you'll love it, you know, and then he hit the button and they're like, what the what? You know, that whole thing. So we had done that a year ago. And so when we put it back in, it was all a reaction to, there was a gentleman named Rick Santelli who'd gone on the floor of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange and had done, this was his famous sort of Tea Party back. And it was about the irresponsibility of homeowners and how dare the taxpayers have to bail out irresponsible homeowners who had taken loans that they were unable to pay off. And I thought that was an incredibly arrogant statement coming from somebody who worked for CNBC, a 24-hour news network devoted to financial analysis, who called themselves experts, who how was their judgment? So that was the whole way that the bit came about was, you're yelling about the judgment of individual homeowners who took on loans that they didn't realize were going to bury them, or they didn't know that the values would go underwater. Let's go back and check your judgment. And it was just a 10-minute clip package of them being wrong.
Right.
He was one very small part of it, but he poked his head up and went, that was unfair. That was out of context. So I said, because we don't want to take people out of context. Hey, guys, I thought we'd check this out. Go back and check, because if that's not fair, we should actually come up with a way to figure that out. Well, it turns out not only was it fair, but there was a whole other Christmas box filled with predictions.
Right.
So what do you do in that situation? You put those together and you put that out there, and then And then he goes, that's it, I'm coming on. I mean, they called us and said, can you come on?
Oh.
And there was no, you know, they made a whole thing like, well, they promised they would. No, we didn't. We didn't promise anything. In fact, I went back there right before the interview and said, look, man, it's probably isn't going to be a pleasant conversation. I hope it'll be fair. See you out there. And that was it.
Now, here's another thing I'm wondering. Your brother, Larry Leibovitz, mm-hmm. is the COO of the...
Changed his name from Stewart.
It's less Jewish.
Yeah.
So,
wanted to see more financial.
So, because he's the head of the COO, he's the COO of the New York Stock Exchange, mm-hmm. does he teach you things that you otherwise...
Can he teach you
credit default swap is?
The guy is the most brilliant guy I've ever met. He has tried on numerous occasions to educate me to these things, but he is in no way responsible for my misunderstandings or misperceptions of the financial world. You know, he does his best to present to me when I ask him.
He seems to really understand it.
Really?
Yes. Yes. Now, you made The Daily Show a much more political show than it was before you came, because right. it was, it pre-existed you, but you completely changed the show. And before I asked you about how doing the show changed you, I want to play you a short clip of what Stephen Colbert said. When Stephen Colbert was on our show the first time a few years ago.
How did you get access to him? Because I call over all the time. It's a very busy man.
So this is what Stephen Colbert said about being on your show and working with you and becoming more political. Here it is.
When I got to The Daily Show, they asked me to have a political opinion. Or rather, John did. John asked me to have a political opinion, and it turned out that I had one. And I didn't realize quite how liberal I was until I was asked to make passionate comedic choices as opposed to necessarily successful comedic choices.
So he feels that he became more political because you pushed him to make passionate political choices in humor. Did doing the show make you more political than you ever expected to be? More politically aware, more politically engaged?
I think it made me less political and more emotional. The closer you spend time with the political and the media process, the less political you become and the more viscerally upset you become at corruption. So it's, I don't consider it political, because political I always sort of denote as a partisan endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
But I have become increasingly unnerved by just the depth of corruption that exists at many different levels. I'm less upset about politicians than the media. I feel like politicians, there is a certain inherent, you know, the way I always explain it is when you go to the zoo and a monkey throws his feces, it's a monkey. But when the zookeeper's standing right there and he doesn't say bad monkey, somebody's got to be the zookeeper. And that's so I tend to feel much more strongly about the abdication of responsibility by the media than by political advocates. They're representing a constituency. And the media, you know, our culture is just a series of checks and balances. That's why I'm never, you know, the whole idea that we're in suddenly a battle for between tyranny and freedom, it's a series of pendulum swings. And the swings have become less drastic over time. That's why I feel sort of not sanguine, but at least a little bit less frightful in that our pendulum swings have become less and less. But what has changed is, I think, the media's sense of their ability to be responsible arbiters for. I think they feel fearful. I think there is this whole idea now that there's a liberal media conspiracy. And so if they feel like they express any moral authority or judgment, which is what you would imagine is editorial control, that they will be vilified. Or there's, I honestly don't know what it is.
So you were doing comedy long before The Daily Show.
Yes.
So what was your comedy like before it became a critique of politics and media?
Mostly balloons. it was a critique of religion and politics and media. It was my feelings on that, but in a much less savvy form, a much less technically aware form, a much less educated form. Our process has allowed us to extend it. You know, the amount of material that we go through in a day now. I mean, it took me 6 years to write my first, you know, 45 minutes.
What was in the first 45 minutes? Tell us something that was in it.
There was, let's see, you know, it was so long ago, this 1980. There was a lot of Saddam Hussein stuff. I don't remember that guy. There was stuff about, I remember, the first Persian Gulf War where, again, it was this idea that, you know, everyone was afraid it was going to be another Vietnam. I think the joke was, you know, there's going to be another Vietnam. We can't go in there. There's going to be another Vietnam. And then the whole war lasted 2 days. There wasn't even another Woodstock. You know, it was that kind of thing. or that, you know, there's a lot of those types of issues still. But it was actually a lot of religious stuff sort of working out. A comedian's first 15 minutes is typically about his life. Your first joke is usually who you are. You just kind of walk out and go, I'm a Jew who was raised in New Jersey. Joke. You know, and then you work through your family and, you know, you basically go through your entire history with them and then you sit and stare at them, but they're not doing much. So you have to then spread out. So then your next jokes usually come from where you go on the road. So I've taken my act about being a Jew from New Jersey to Tennessee. Want to hear about Tennessee? Yeah. And then that's your next.
Yeah.
Your next act is about your life as a comedian. And then when that's exhausted, you tend to turn your vision to the world, and that becomes sort of your tableau for the rest of your career, at least in the instances that I've seen.
So you were voted most funny person in high school. What got you that honor?
It was mostly the political stuff.
Yeah, I'm sure.
You know, I was obnoxious. I was obnoxious. And people in New Jersey in the late 70s dug that, man. you know, I think I always, it's not like I was morose and then suddenly went into comedy. I mean, I would say, I guess what you would consider about any pain in the ass.
So was this from, like, did you have a stage or something to be funny on, or were you just funny in the halls? Or?
No, I had a stage. I had a stage set up. And then people would come by and go, hey, what are you going to, geometry class? Nice shirt. Does it come in men's? Boom.
I mean, were you performing? Were you in shows? Were you in?
I was not in the theater. I was in sports, and
that's funny.
Well, I had the dream. I had the dream that I would not have Bud Harrelson's body. I thought I would have. Perhaps I would grow into something. So I wanted to be an athlete. I didn't want to be in show business. It was a very different world, and I know a lot of people in Europe are of that era. We were not in the world where everybody was special yet. We had not entered into that stage of where everybody had a Facebook page that they could personalize with tunes they love. And, you know, my kids will never know what it's like to have nothing to watch because there's, like, they will, I mean, I'm surprised that when we have human interactions, they don't, like, go, let me freeze that and just run that back. Like, they're accustomed to things being presented to them when they want it in exactly the form that they want it. And they're accustomed to the idea that I'm special and I can do anything. And if I do it, just by the very nature of me doing it, it is in fact then special. I came from the era of, you're not special. Don't you think you're special? You're not so special.
Your parents can be very good at giving you that.
Oh, message. No, my mom, listen, yeah. My mom, I mean, that's not her, but that was the culture of the time. She was, I think, an anomaly in that era. You know, she had, there was like a quiet confidence because she had to, fend for herself, you know, divorced in the 70s and that sort of thing. So I think she had a very different outlook, but that the community at large was not like that. The community at large was, yeah, yeah, you're going to move to New York. Yeah. Hey, good luck at the gay pride parade. Hey. You know.
Mr. Big Shot. Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's not, it wasn't about empowerment and creativity. I had no sense of this world of expression that existed out there.
Well, you know, you got MTV shows earlier in your career and worked on other shows. But when your MTV interview show was discontinued, you went on Letterman's show right afterwards.
Right. No.
Was it another show that was
discontinued? Yeah, there was an MTV show, and then it was bought by the guy. Arsenio Hall was on, and he had a dog pound.
Right, yeah.
And then he left.
Right.
And they thought, who's going to look out for the dog? So they hired me because what a perfect line of succession that would be. I have an idea. Let's bring in the opposite of him. So that lasted a very very short time. And that was the thing.
That was the thing that was canceled.
That was the thing that got canceled, and I went on Letterman that night. Although it was scheduled to be on Letterman, not, it was happenstance.
Right,
it was.
Right. So what you said to Letterman was that you were thinking of going to L.A., but in L.A. everyone tries to tell you who you are. And in your case, they tell you, you're a younger Richard Lewis, you're a younger Jerry Seinfeld, which means I'm a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
So if that's what they were telling you, who you were, who did you think you were then?
That's one of the things that I think I pride myself on, is not thinking about that.
Yeah.
You know, I never in my career have ever thought about what the goal was. The goal was always to be better than I was at the present time at what I was doing. As a stand-up, my break in stand-up was not getting on Letterman. My break in stand-up was, there's a place called the Comedy Cellar in the Village on McDougal Street. And a great group of guys that were together in those days performing. And they put me on every night at 2 a.m. I was the last guy on every night. And not on the weekends, because I wasn't good enough for weekends. So Sunday night through Thursday night, it was me and drunk Dutch tourists in a basement in the Village. And I would perform for the plate of hummus that would be served to me. Because above the Comedy Cellar is a Middle Eastern restaurant. Because of course. And I went on every night and I learned the difference between impersonating a comedian and being a comedian. And that was my break, was learning how to be authentic, not to the audience, but to myself. I developed a baseline of confidence and also insecurity. I knew how bad I was and I knew how good I was. And that is what helped me through a lot of the ups and downs as we went along.
You're much more comfortable at the anchor desk on The Daily Show than standing up in front of a microphone?
No. I love stand-up comedy.
Okay.
And the anchor desk to me feels more of an artifice than the show as it's done. I understand the practice of it. Performing the show is the last thing I think about. My day is writing and rewriting the show.
Uh-huh.
And then a lot of times I'll be like, okay, let's go. Right, right. And then you think about it. But that to me is artifice. I like the craft of it.
You work so hard on the show. It's so obvious how much work you put into writing and performing it and how long your day must be and how it probably never ends, particularly doing an event like this rally. I mean,
You'd be surprised how easily I turn it off when I go home.
Really?
I've gotten really good at when I go home, the kids and I, and you know, we watch Wizards of Waverly Place and I don't think about it again.
Have you changed the amount of time you're willing to devote to the show and to work now that you're the father of two?
No, I'd rather they suffer. I figure I'll catch up with them. No, but what I have decided is when I'm home, I'm home. And to me, that's the difference. You know, I can't not be at work, but the real challenge is when I'm at work, I'm at work. I'm locked in, I'm ready to go, I'm focused. When I'm at home, locked in, and I'm ready to go, and I'm focused on home. And we don't watch the show, we don't watch the news, we don't do any of that stuff. I sit down, I play Barbies, you know, and then sometimes the kids will come home and play with me. You know, it just, you know, they're just sitting there. I mean, she's got a horse and a kitchen, and I just think, like, the possibilities. If I'm able to give them my full attention for the amount of time I'm able to give it to them, I prefer that to, you know, I like to turn the switch on and off. And it's still, you know, it'll, in times like this, I don't sleep well just because of so much that's going on, but I try not to let it affect me in my waking hours.
Do you take anything? Okay, so.
Manischewitz.
So just one more thing. Do you have like an experience on The Daily Show or as a comic where you said, this is my peak experience. This is as good as it gets. Like this is so great.
There was a congressional bill, where they were going to get money for first responders, not about their chronic health issues. And it's a no brainer. The people that went into the towers that were down there searching to have their health bills taken care of. And legislative maneuvering. The Democrats wouldn't bring it up an up or down vote, because if they did that, the Republicans would be allowed to insert amendments. And one of the amendments that they could insert was that you couldn't give any of the money to illegal aliens. And so the Democrats were afraid that they would have a commercial that would be made that would say, you voted to give money to it. So rather than standing up and being moral for the people that risked everything for us down there, they decided to try a legislative maneuver that made it so that two-thirds had to pass the bill so that no amendments could be put in. Well, the Republicans obviously, you know, shot it down, their own moral failing. So we did a segment on the show called I Give Up. And the ability to articulate our sense of just absolute sadness, but through a prism of comedy, like we came in that morning just really despairing as we watched this go down. And we walked out that night feeling like we had yelled and felt, you know, we put it through the prism and the synthesis and the digestive process that we put it through, and we made ourselves feel better. And we didn't make ourselves feel better by ignoring it, by dismissing it, by not dealing with it. We made ourselves feel better by expressing our utter rage at the ineptness and lack of courage from our legislators. And we walked out of there that night feeling like, you know what? Good day's work.
I would love to talk to you for hours, and I have a feeling our audience would love to listen to you for hours, but I am sadly required to end it about now.
Mandy Patinkin is John Stewart in The Interview That Never Ended.
I just want to say thank you for giving me the privilege of talking with you.
Please.
And please let me leave a standing ovation for you and the work that you do.
Thank you.
My interview with John Stewart was recorded last Wednesday night at the 92nd Street Y in Manhattan. The occasion was the new book by Stewart and the writers of The Daily Show called Earth, A Visitor's Guide to the Human Race. You can find a photo from the event, as well as links to our other interviews with people from The Daily Show, on our website, freshair.npr.org. Our thanks to Susan Engel at The Y and The Y's technical crew, as well as Stephen Barkley and Kira McGrath.
Oh, my God.
That was very good. I think that was very good, everybody. And are you ready to play another song? And
yeah.
Okay. While you're looking for a song, I was gonna go to another thing I wanted to share here. When we were in Churchville, Virginia, we went to the local library, and I was just stunned to see Dan Brown's most recent book in that library in Churchville, and I actually took it out. I got to send it back via the mail, but it's in all the bookstores now. It's called The Lost Symbol. And I just thought this was fascinating because at the very beginning it has a quotation here. And it's called, let's see here, quote, to live in the world without becoming aware of the meaning of the world is as though wandering about in a great library without touching the books. And you'll be surprised at the author here. It's called, it was taken from the book, The Secret Teachings of All Ages by Manly Palmer Hall. And just at the beginning of the book, it says, fact, in 1991, and I want to remind you that in this lifetime, Magdalene was born in the family of which her ancestor was one of the signees.
John Middleton.
Of the original Declaration of Independence, which is hidden in the Bruton Vault. And the Bruton Vaults are on Queen Elizabeth's property and in Williamsburg, Virginia. And the corporate Rockefeller state is what controls the whole place. And just to bring it back to the idea that the Queen represents the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers represent the new kids on the block. We just talked about that. And here are these two dancing with these unexhumed documents that represent truth yet to be brought forward. And since her ancestor, Marcia Middleton, as she was born, and it was John Middleton who was the signee there, was on that document. She basically had the right to claim it and to see to it that it was brought up. And we brought this out before that I didn't make it all the way, and at this point it's been good because I've been able to do certain things and keep it safe for the work that was done that day. Well, actually it was done in the middle of the night, and it was on 9/11 in 1991 when what happened is that they dug a hole where the Bruton Vault is sitting under there, and they got 7 feet down of 10 feet where the Bruton Vault is located. And as a result of getting in the New York Times and the Washington Post, and as you could see, we were reading about that when we were reading about the Bilderbergers, those two newspapers and all of their connections to the Bilderberger groups. Well, then what occurred here, and here's the fact. In 1991, a document was locked in the safe of the director of the CIA. It was that document called the Declaration of Independence. They pulled it out of that Bruton Vault, which we got ever so close to opening. And then they locked it in the safe of the director of the CIA. Who was the head of the CIA at that time? That was Bush. Bush Sr. was in office. Mm-hmm. 91. You got to look that up.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody knows, just call in and tell us. Anyway, the document is still there today. It's cryptic text. Includes references to an ancient portal and an unknown location underground. The document also contains the phrase, quote, it is buried out there somewhere, unquote. And then he goes on and says, all organizations in this novel exist, including the Freemasons, the Invisible College, the Office of Security, and then there's something called the FMSC. I'm not quite sure what that stands for. And the Institute of Noetic Sciences.
of which George Green talks about a lot.
This is a very highly evolved group of spiritual adepts that have gone into depth as to what really happened at the time of Jesus. And all the stuff that's not in the biblical cult that really has really the secret clues and of the Essenes and the Nazarenes and the Ebionites, as Jesus was born of Myrii in a magnetic cave in Ethiopia. And all rituals, science, artwork, and monuments in this novel are real. And this is exploring these organizations and the real secrets buried. And they are connections to the truth that's coming out right now to all the people. So we're going to read a little more about some of these things. And before we go there, Ron wants to play another song, and this is called, oh yes, Manish De Moore, Peaceful Being. Okay, everybody, world peace and love.
Darling, I love you.
Before we go into what I was saying, we were going to read a little more about what really happened at the time of Jesus to get an idea now as we're the return of the Christ here and end this Christian area of dogma so that we can really understand our purpose more clearly. I want to play the 10-minute piece that Richard sent us today. And this is of Robert Reich. And it's called Robert Reich Has a Plan to Save the Economy. And this came out on the 13th of October. That was yesterday. So here we go. Let's listen to this 10-minute piece very first.
As long as healthcare is for profit and tied to having a job, Americans have one more reason to be terrified of that pink slip. With 263,000 jobs lost last month, the real unemployment rate is estimated to hover around about 17%. And the stimulus spent so far isn't yet enough. We often complain, but what about a plan? Our next guest actually has one. Doesn't seem to ever quite get the chance to lay it out in full on the cable shows, so we invited him to Grid TV. Former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich, now Professor of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley, is the author of Super Capitalism, now out in paperback. He's also a blogger. More on that later. Welcome back to Grid TV, Bob. Great to have you.
Oh, hi, Laura.
I would just love to hear the plan, because we hear so much about what's wrong. You have a pretty clear proposal of how to set things right.
Well, I think I do, and you're right. There are very few opportunities to lay it out, but let me go through it very, very simply. Number one is very important, it seems to me, to exempt the first $20,000 of people's incomes for 1 year from the payroll tax. That would put money directly into people's pockets. There's no more direct way of doing it than that. And it would be very progressive, because obviously 80% of Americans pay more in payroll taxes than they pay in income taxes. And number two, I would provide small businesses with a small tax credit for each new job, net new job they created. That would be a small business new job tax credit. It would generate, by my estimate, a very large number of new jobs, because it would reduce the cost of creating new jobs. Three, I think the federal government has got to do something that the government did in the 1930s. When all else fails, and that is create a kind of works projects administration. Employ people directly who are not otherwise employable and make sure that they are put to work doing all sorts of things that our society needs. There are many things that they could be doing. Now, again, everything from parks to playgrounds to, with some training, helping administer swine flu vaccines, helping to do many, many things. There are a lot of assistants and teachers that are needed. Our classrooms are bulging, too many students in each classroom right now because the states are cutting back. And so classroom assistants and classroom aides. I could go through a very, very long list. But the most important thing is to get employed doing things that we all need them to do. Millions of people who are now simply sitting waiting for a job that doesn't exist.
How different is that plan from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, ARRA, that we're watching play out now?
ARRA. It sounds a little bit, it sounds like rah-rah. It sounds like a basketball or football kind of cheer. It is quite different, Laura, because the stimulus package, although some of it is going to infrastructure, much of it is really not yet been paid. The things I'm talking about would put money into people's pockets right away and get them into jobs right away. But the stimulus package is in the right direction. I'm one of those who thinks that we are not stimulating the economy enough. When you have one out of six Americans who is either unemployed or underemployed, this is not the time right now to be terribly worried about the budget deficit. I am worried about the deficit over the long term, but right now there's no reason to be worried about the deficit. The government has got to stimulate the economy more in order to get more jobs back.
Do you think it's too early to be assessing the impact of the stimulus spending of this spring?
Well, here's what we do know. 40% of the stimulus has been spent. We also know, because the Economic Policy Institute, among many other places, has done some very good work on this, we know that had the stimulus not been in effect, job losses would be about twice as great as they have been over the past few months. In other words, last month in September, instead of losing 263,000 jobs, we probably would have lost over 500,000 jobs. So the stimulus is beginning to have an effect, but it is still not large enough.
What about the new proposals that we're hearing, even coming from the White House, around tax credits for job creators? You have a tax credit in your plan. How is that different?
Well, a new jobs tax credit is necessary. I'm very pleased that the White House is considering it. It's got to be focused on net new jobs. That is, employers have got to certify and show proof that let's say, the start of September, they had a certain number of employees, let's say 100, and that they are applying for a new jobs tax credit on the basis of additional employment. Let's say they're now up to 120 employees. We've got to make sure that employers don't take advantage of the system by firing people and then hiring new people and saying those new people are additional employees. That's not the case. It's got to be net new jobs.
The advantage to your sort of direct employment proposal, which is much more like the WPA than anything that we're really seeing today, is that it gives government an opportunity to set a standard, not just of job creation, but what kind of jobs, what it would pay, what benefits would come with it, what the working conditions and hours would be like. Is there any of that in the triggers that we're playing with now, or could these jobs be the same low-paying, wage-suppressed jobs that drove people into the hands of bad mortgage brokers years back?
Well, unfortunately, Laura, many of the jobs that we are seeing right now in the economy, to the extent that there are any new jobs at all, are and tend to be low-wage jobs. Retail, restaurant, hotel, hospital, surface transportation. Now, some of the construction jobs created directly by the stimulus package are pretty good jobs. Construction jobs tend to pay better. But the multiplier effect from these jobs, that is, the jobs that pay, the pay that come with the jobs, people who get the jobs turn around and buy other things, those secondary jobs tend to be fairly poorly paid. So one of the advantages, as you said, of the government creating a kind of new WPA is precisely to set a standard Now, obviously, these are not all going to be very high-paying jobs, but they could be good, solid middle-class jobs that would help people pay their bills, that would set a benchmark against which the private sector should pay, that would have benefits attached to them, and that, again, would fulfill both public needs and also the needs of private individuals and families to get back to work.
And finally, Robert, I don't know whether you've been as irritated as I have, but all of this language, all of this talk about a jobless recovery, can we have a recovery without jobs?
Technically, Laura, we can have a recovery if you measure recovery the way the National Bureau of Economic Standards measures recovery, which is approximately 2/4 of economic growth back to back. But your question is absolutely right on. There's no real recovery if this many people are out of work. If you've got double-digit unemployment, which translates into close to 20% of Americans unemployed or underemployed, then there will be no recovery because there's not enough money in the pockets of most people to turn around and buy enough things to keep the economy going. So don't be fooled into thinking that there's a recovery just because economists may announce in the next few months that technically we are in a recovery. Wall Street may be recovering. The economy may be technically growing a little bit. Corporate profits may be up a little bit. But as long as a large portion of our population is out of work, as long as people are hurting, it's not going to be a real recovery. One other thing, Laura, and that is that be very suspicious of corporate profits. Because one of the reasons that corporations are beginning to show good profits is that they are slashing their payrolls. Payrolls tend to represent about 70% of the costs of most businesses. But if they slash their payrolls, even though they may be making more profits as a result, the economy is not better off because, of course, logically, many more people are out of work.
Out of work and out of health insurance. Finally, Bob, there has been a lot of thought that we should get the healthcare reform done so we can move on to things like the Employee Free Choice Act and jobs policy. Is that the right way to do it in your view?
Well, we have to get, the Obama administration really is very, very dependent on, as are millions of Americans, a genuine healthcare reform that is the highest order of business. It's very important to get that done, hopefully within the next month, or maybe the next month and a half. That does not mean that the administration cannot move on the jobs front. I think both are critically important, and they are connected. One reason that so many people are losing their homes, one reason that they can't pay their mortgages, is because they are both out of jobs and they have health crises. One of the reasons that so many Americans have found their standard of living declining and their pay going down is because more and more of their pay is going directly or indirectly to paying higher premiums and co-payments and deductibles. So this is all, the job situation and the problems that many Americans have with jobs are directly or indirectly related to the soaring cost of medical care and also the role of private health insurers and also Big Pharma in raking in gigantic profits while the rest of us pay them.
Robert Reich, thank you so much for joining us. Robert Reich is professor of public policy at UC Berkeley and the author of Super Capitalism, which is just out in paperback. Thanks for joining us.
That was Laura Flanders, I see. I just wanted to remind you that Robert Reich was the former labor secretary under President Clinton, just in case you wonder where he came from. And he's been speaking often at the Commonwealth Club, which is a very good place to learn some good things. And as you can see, this was done just yesterday. And today, we've got this moratorium on all these mortgages. This is such a difference. It's like day and night. And he's talking about a way to get the economy going. And the next day, we're taking the banks down, literally, by stopping this paying money for nothing, routine for our subprime mortgage and all the other foreclosures on mortgages. And enter stage right now, I would say, Nasara and Full Disclosure and Freedom in terms of getting rid of the UCC across the board and ending this so-called law of commerce called the Uniform Commercial Code that governs all commerce in the world in a fraudulent manner, as it's been doing. And yes, there's just been a few, when you consider the at-large need for people to learn how to navigate all the paperwork and all the understandings of how to challenge all the different voices of government which need to be challenged. Right now, I just, you know, they're going to, I still don't know the total way they're going to do this. I'll just say that what I want to focus on for the rest of this evening, I think we've got about 25 minutes. Is that right, Rama? Seth? Seth did give us the address to the radio station. I keep forgetting. They live in Paradise, everyone. Mm-hmm. Paradise, California, that is. So write this down. It's BBS Network, Inc., 5167 Toyon Lane, T-O-Y-O-N Lane, 5167 Toyon Lane, Paradise, California, 959-697. Oh, I'm sorry, 95969. That's all, five letters, numbers. 95969, Paradise, California. Okay. So I think what I want to do now is go to something called the Essenes of Mount Carmel. And this is delving into some stuff that biblically isn't delineated clearly. And this is by Reverend Brother Nazariah, Doctor of Divinity. The purpose of this article is to provide evidence that Yeshu was primarily associated with the Essenes of Mount Carmel in northern Israel, not the Essenes of Qumran in southern Israel. Certainly, Yeshu and the northern Essenes had ongoing contact with their brethren in the south, yet he was not raised and trained at Qumran, as many in the modern Essene movement believe. This article will clear up this misconception. In the course of doing so, we will touch on various related items, some of them quite fascinating. We will learn of the lifestyle and traditions of the mystical Essenes of Mount Carmel. We will uncover the truth about Nazareth and how the word relates to the term Nazarene. We will name the likely location where baby Yeshu was taken for protection from Herod. And we will learn esoteric details about the baptism of Yeshu by John. All of the above is related to and will help support the central thesis that Yeshu was raised and trained by the Essenes of Mount Carmel in northern Israel, not the Essenes of Qumran in south Israel. Yet perhaps the very best supporting evidence for our thesis is the map which accompanies the article. I urge the reader to carefully consult this map as it's referred to in the course of the article. In both the Orthodox New Testament and the Essene New Testament, we are offered the following information in regard to the whereabouts of Joseph, Mary, and Yeshu. Number one, prior to the birth of Yeshu, Mary and Joseph, Miriai and Yosef are said to live in Nazareth, a village in the north of Israel. At the end of a long journey from Nazareth in northern Israel to Bethlehem in southern Israel to pay taxes, Miriai gives birth to Yeshu in Bethlehem. Remember, that's not quite what happened. We're just going to go. Being warned that Herod was going to kill baby Yeshu, Miriai and Yosef fled to Egypt. After the death of Herod, the Holy Family returned to Nazareth. Yeshu grew up in Nazareth. Yeshu launched his public ministry in cities near Nazareth. As a grown man, for the first time since his youth, Yeshu journeyed to South Israel, where he was baptized by John the Baptist near Qumran. After a short day in southern Israel, after his baptism by John, Yeshu returned to northern Israel. There in the vicinity of Lake Galilee, which is near Nazareth and Mount Carmel, Yeshu conducted his ministry. As Yeshu knew that the climactic moment had come for him to confront the authorities in Jerusalem and die on the cross, he again journeyed to southern Israel. Again, the above nine facts appear not only in the Orthodox New Testament, they also appear in the Essene New Testament, the Gospel of the Holy Twelve. Now, please look at the map which accompanies the article. Find Nazareth on the map. Well, I wonder if he's printed out the map. I don't see it coming under. That's okay. Notice that it is near Mount Carmel and Lake Galilee in northern Israel. Next, locate Bethlehem, Jerusalem, and Qumran on the map, which is in southern Israel. And as you examine the map, notice that it is a very long journey from Lake Galilee to the Dead Sea, nearly the entire length of the nation of Israel. Consider carefully the fact that they had no cars in these days, neither were the roads paved. Consider how hot the climate is. All things considered, you can see that a journey from northern Israel to southern Israel was no easy task 2,000 years ago. Thus, the fact that nearly every major event associated with the life of Yeshu, every event except for his birth in Bethlehem, his baptism by John, and his final journey to Jerusalem, occurred in northern Israel, is strong evidence that Yeshu lived most of his life in northern Israel. We do not deny that Yeshu occasionally made this long, hard journey from north to south, nor do we deny that he made several other long journeys, and including and especially to India. Yet the fact that nearly all the events associated with his life occurred in northern Israel near Mount Carmel and Lake Galilee is powerful evidence that he primarily lived there, not in South Israel. Some of the major events of Yeshu's ministry which occurred in North Israel are as follows. I have also marked the location of several of these events on the map. The miraculous feeding of 5,000 people, the Sermon on the Mount, the wedding at Cana, where he turned water to wine, the anointing with oil by Magdalene, the calling of Andrew and Peter, the healing of the leper, the healing of the man with palsy, the healing of Matthew, the calling of Matthew, excuse me. Matthew, as a child, was an Essene, and his name was Bartholomew, and then Matthew as an adult. The calling of Philip, the calling of Nathaniel, the sending forth of the 12 disciples, the sending of the 72 disciples, the giving of the Lord's Prayer, the healing of Jairus's daughter, J-A-I-R-U-S, the dialogue with the Samaritan woman at the well, the miraculous walk on the water, the time he commanded the storm to be calm, and it obeyed him, the vast majority of the verbal teachings he gave during his life. Thus far, we have considered much evidence that supports our assertion that Yeshua lived most of his life in North Israel, and we now know that he made a couple of important trips to South Israel, yet spent most of his time in the North. Yet, we have not yet specifically linked him with the Essenes of Mount Carmel. And soon to do this, we will first consider one more important piece of evidence that Yeshua was not a Qumran Essene. The fact that John the Baptist did not recognize him. There is near unanimity amongst scholars that John the Baptist was an Essene from Qumran. On the map which accompanies the article, we can find the Qumran and then notice that the location is on the Jordan River, where tradition tells us John performed his baptism, is right where the Jordan River connects with the Dead Sea near Qumran. Add to that the fact that John was said to live in the desert southwest of the Jordan, exactly where Qumran is located, and that his dress and his diet was vegan. The locust he ate is a fruit similar to carob, not an insect. The method of baptism, the Qumran Essenes practiced baptism and were often called Baptists, oh my, and prophetic theology match up exactly with what we know of the Qumran Essenes, and you can understand there is solid consensus among scholars. John was from Qumran. The scholars point out that the Qumran Essenes often took in orphans, and that the New Testament informs us that after Herod murdered Zechariah, baby John's father, baby John went to live in the desert. Obviously, a baby could not survive alone in the desert. John was raised by the Essenes at Qumran. That conclusion becomes even more certain as one considers the following piece of evidence from the Dead Sea Scrolls. In the common community rule of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the purpose of the Qumran community is described as to, quote, to prepare the way for the Messiah in the desert wilderness, to prepare a people to meet the Lord. Likewise, in the New Testament, John the Baptist declares, I am a voice crying out in the desert wilderness, prepare the way for the coming of the Messiah, prepare to meet the Lord. That's exactly what's happening right now. We are being prepared to meet Kelki Maitreya in the physical and all of the other immortals, of which Swami Purna has led the way and are meeting him here at the beginning of our journey this last 2 months. According to the prophecies of Isaiah, who lived hundreds of years before John and Yeshua, before the Messiah of peace would manifest himself to Israel, two things must occur. One, a group of people must, quote, prepare the way for the coming of the Messiah. That would be the whistleblowers, all of us for the last 30 years, everyone.
Doing it right now.
And make a straight path for the Lord in the wilderness. Prepare a people to meet the Lord.
Mm.
And to Elijah, who lived hundreds of years before Yeshua and John, must return to earth, meaning a galactic needs to come back to prepare the way and announce the coming of the Messiah. I don't know. I think it's a collective John the Baptist right now in all of our collective calling it forth right now. The astute reader, huh? We have 11 minutes left? Oh, is that true, Commander BBS Seth Radio? Is that what's true about us tonight? Or do we have another hour and 11 minutes? Just less checking. Less, actually. All right, well, okay. Let me just read a paragraph or two more here. The astute reader is aware of the fact that in both the Orthodox New Testament and our esteemed New Testament, Yeshu declares that John the Baptist is returned as he is the returned Elijah. That's true. Yet even the astute reader is probably not aware of the following fascinating fact. That the exact spot on the bank of the Jordan River where John performed his baptism is the same spot where Elijah had ascended in the chariot of fire. In the Armageddon script, a remarkable book by Peter Lemus-Surier read, the details of John's mission had, we may be sure it has to be enough, the timing has to be right. Okay. 4 minutes and 44 seconds, the meditation to heal the wounds of love. Will be our closing song. Let me finish this paragraph. The details of John's mission had, the reason I'm reading this is because, John the Baptist was Elijah, a galactic intervener in our civilization's development. And collectively, we are that. We are galactic commanders intervening in our civilization's development right now. The details of John's mission had, we may be sure, already been spelt out for the teacher of righteousness. At the appropriate time, John must identify himself as Elijah by adopting Elijah's outlandish garb. Elijah wore a camel hair robe, as did John. Long haired and unshaven, he must proceed to the spot on the east bank of the Jordan where the river emptied into the Dead Sea to perform the baptism. This, after all, had been the site of Elijah's dramatic and legendary disappearance in the chariot of fire some 8 centuries before. Thus, doubly identified as Elijah returned, he must then proclaim the imminent appearance of the Messiah himself. Okay, we'll leave you in mystery with that thought as we have to take our leave. And, okay, so you're going to do that one. Okay, here we go, everyone. Meditation to heal the wounds of love. Hold this close.
I'm such to God, such heaven, such nanako, sibe, such niram, mane, oche, kule, darshan, dai, bila, pakare, chantrik, ki, niai, trikanotre, santana, In the darshan stand diari jio o koi jio koragumai kur darshan stand diari jio I'm such to God, such heaven, such nanako, sibe, such biram, kasu hava, tiyo, sahej, nubani, Cheetah Walk.